This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Well, on October 29th, the only time our highest alert, which we call an alert star, we put a giant star on the map over the area, the only time an alert star of ours has ever appeared outside of the Ring of Fire, only happened once, was October 29th, 2016, and it was over the country of Italy. Many people know that on October 30th, just one day later, a 6.6 struck that area. It took down the Basilica of St. Benedict, and it was the largest earthquake that has hit there in decades and decades.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Ben Davidson. Today's show, Space Weather and Earthquakes. Ben Davidson is an independent researcher into the science of climate change. One of his websites, suspiciousobservers.org, is an online research community investigating solar activity, earthquakes, earth changes, and weather. His website, earthchanges.org, is where you can find his new disaster prediction app. His website, spaceweathernews.com, is where you will find the archive of his daily short Space News broadcast, aired every morning at 6 a.m. Eastern. He is the author of a new book, Weatherman's Guide to the Sun, Space Weather News. Today we discuss the sun's influence on the Earth, the influence of cosmic rays, geomagnetic storms, space weather's impact on human health, and the launch of the Earthquake Prediction Center. Ben Davidson, welcome to Guns and Butter again. It's been far too long since we've talked.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure last time. I do get a chance to keep in contact with some of our friends from the show quite a bit, but it has been too long since I've been here.
I can't wait to get caught up with your work with Suspicious Observers. You just published your second book titled Weatherman's Guide to the Sun, Space Weather News. You write that this book is primarily about the Earth-Sun relationship and that one intent of your new book is to help the reader understand what to expect on Earth when certain things happen on the Sun. What topics do you cover in Weatherman's Guide to the Sun?
Well, both the short-term and long-term effects of certain solar phenomena on the Earth. And when I say on the Earth, I mean the weather and on seismicity and other crustal action like volcanoes.
Could you talk about some of the important activities of the sun? And this covers a lot, including the solar wind, solar flares, coronal mass ejections, and coronal holes. When I was reading your book, I realized how important these coronal holes are. And then there's also something called interplanetary magnetic fields.
Right. Right. Well, you know, it could be a long and difficult audio-only discussion to try to teach about space weather and the different things that the sun does. But we can talk about them very generally. Real quick, if people want to learn more about this stuff, they can go to spaceweathernews.com, and right up at the top of the page in big bold letters, it'll say, "What is space weather?" with a question mark. If you click on that, there is a one-hour tutorial that will literally get you to probably the 99th percentile in terms of understanding the sun among all people on the planet. But at a most basic level, there's a short-term and some long-term cycles on the sun. The short-term one is about 11 years, at least the important short-term one. And during this 11-year cycle, we go from low activity to high activity and back down again and sort of like on a wave up and down. Now, what do I mean when I say low activity and high activity? Well, during the high activity, we get a lot of these sunspots, these dark-looking areas on the sun, and it turns out that even though they're darker, even though they're slightly cooler, they contain the powerful magnetic fields that create what are known as solar flares. They send X-rays out into the solar system. They can blast charged particles like protons, electrons, positrons, which is basically a hydrogen atom without the electron, blast those out into space, and those can have effects on the planets as well. On a minor level, when this happens, we get the auroras, you know, the northern lights and the southern lights. But in more extreme examples, these can actually take out power. In 1989, the entire province of Quebec lost power. In 1859, an event called the Carrington Event, for a man named Richard Carrington who studied it, took out what little there was technologically. Telegraph wires caught on fire. Operators got shocked. They unplugged the machines, and yet telegraphs kept coming in on the wires, even though they had allegedly unplugged the power. It's the kind of thing that, if it happened again today, could produce a global blackout. That not only it's like the kind of thing where they have to go flip the breaker back on, but literally the global power grid could actually melt down from something like this. And it happens once every few hundred years. Humans have survived this many, many times throughout the past. It just sort of looked like beautiful lights in the sky. But now that we have an electrically dependent way of life for the most part, we are in a new realm of vulnerability. And the last time the sun did this was sort of at the dawn of our entrance into the electric age. And so, you know, it could be tomorrow. It could be, 100 years from now. We're really not sure. Back in 2012, there was a blast that was about that big that actually missed us by about 3 months in our orbit. So if we had been 3 months ahead around the sun, it would have hit us. And we've gotten lucky a few other times as well. But we're actually starting to notice that the sun's activities have more than just those super obvious connections. You know, these rare events happen on the sun and we get the expected rare electrical events on the Earth. Well, electricity has a lot more to do with the weather and earthquakes than has been realized over time. And as Earth's magnetic field, a lot of people don't know this, Earth's magnetic field is weakening as the magnetic poles are actually beginning to move and shift. That is allowing electricity to play an even larger role in all of these things on our planet. And that even includes human health. So really a lot of topics, a lot of different ways to go from there. But essentially what the sun does is it puts out electromagnetic waves, electromagnetic particles. It has interplanetary magnetic fields that directly connect to the planets. And Earth is riding in the sun's magnetic field in an electric field of particles known as the solar wind. So this is really an electrical thing we're talking about. And the only interface we have, the only thing blocking out all this energy from space, is Earth's magnetic field, our magnetosphere. So as this weakens, naturally the electricity is going to play a lot greater role. Many folks have been studying the over-ionization of certain levels of the ionosphere. Any ham radio operators out there who have been noticing that the critical frequency of the F1 layer has been much, much higher than expected. This is one of the effects. Things aren't always that obvious when you're talking about the weather and earthquakes, but when you start to be able to focus on certain phenomena, not just look at, the sun's doing all of these things, but when you pick out just one specific thing and when you can narrow down some of these things, earthquakes become predictable. Short-term, mid-range, and long-term climate becomes much more predictable. And that's really the age we're sort of entering right now. And it's very interesting that we're entering that age of understanding the Earth-Sun relationship at a time when the Earth-Sun relationship is about to go through a bit of a tiff, so to speak.
In reading your book, I came away with the impression that there are, to simplify matters, two opposing forces at work in our solar system with regard to space weather: the activity of our sun, including the solar wind on the one hand, and cosmic rays, including X-rays, gamma rays, and interstellar particles on the other, and that the activity of our sun protects us from these cosmic rays, which come in from other galaxies and supernovas, etc. Is this an oversimplification?
Well, if you are trying to get a dissertation in plasma physics of the sun, probably. However, you very adequately described how this works. Whether we're talking about the magnetic field of Earth, the magnetic field of the sun, the solar wind, the energy of a solar flare, or we're talking about the galactic cosmic rays that are bombarding our solar system, we're always talking about, we're almost always talking about electromagnetic particles. In galactic cosmic rays, there is some neutron involvement, but the majority of the modulation of these galactic cosmic rays, how much gets into the inner solar system, how much gets into the Earth versus how much is blocked, is based on two systems. Earth has two shields against this. One is Earth's own magnetic shield, our own magnetic field, the magnetosphere, but the other is the sun's. The sun's magnetic field sort of balloons out and gets much stronger when it's got that high activity with the sunspots and the solar flares. And then during the low periods, it sort of shrinks back down and becomes weaker, and we notice a lot more cosmic rays are able to bombard the inner solar system during those times. And so the sun modulates what is able to get into the inner system, and then Earth has its own shield that sort of has to, you know, block what has managed to get its way in there.
In most media, you only hear the two sides to climate change. Either you believe that man is responsible for global warming, now renamed climate change, or you are on the other side denying that the climate is changing. You have a different view that there are other factors outside of the climate system on our planet that impact our weather and even climatic changes. Can you describe some of these factors?
Well, absolutely I can, and I'd first like to say that I've done a good job coming along and putting together a lot of information and communicating that hypothesis, but this is not something new. The fact that there might be a third avenue that Earth might take down into the future. Folks like Landscheid, who was first predicting decades and decades ago that we were going to go into a mini ice age at some point, you know, within the coming decades, you know, the coming two or three decades or so. But there have been a lot of folks who have been talking about this for a long time. And essentially, for whatever reason they think, a lot of times it has to come down to the sun. And I happen to agree with that. And there's a caveat this time that the wild card is that Earth's magnetic field is changing as well. At no point have we experienced what we're experiencing with Earth's magnetic field at this point. It has basically been at very, very high levels of strength for thousands and thousands of years. And yet in the last, you know, about 150 years or so, we've lost about 20% of the strength of the magnetic field. And so that's really the wild card in a lot of what we are seeing right now.
I'm speaking with independent researcher and author Ben Davidson. Today's show, Space Weather and Earthquakes. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You write that in 2013, it began to become clear to the world that we were approaching 20 years of vastly overestimated global warming predictions. The official predictions of record have been able to predict the extremes of climate change, with the exception of perhaps the most important piece, global warming. Could you talk about these 20 years and what has occurred with the climate?
Well, absolutely. You know, we've had this thing that's called the global warming pause, and you can find some scientists trying to argue that it hasn't really been a pause. At first, they tried to say the oceans ate the heat. That got sort of debunked. They're trying to say that for another reason. Now, at one point, they tried to say that a lot of the heat went down and was melting part of Antarctica. And then the University of Texas discovered that one of the largest erupting submarine volcanoes ever discovered is erupting right underneath where the ice is melting. There's a lot of argument back and forth, but what cannot be denied is, for whatever reason, global surface temperatures have been dismally below the predictions of the International Panel on Climate Change in just about every climate model that basically writes off the sun and puts emphasis on our carbon emissions. In 2015 and 2016, we had the strongest El Nino ever recorded, and it allowed many people to say, very much rightfully so, that we had the warmest temperatures on record. But what they didn't tell you was that the predictions were for much more than just a few fractions of a degree warming record. They were basically up by more than a degree in their predictions. And that was without an El Nino. So it took the record El Nino to get us their claims of 2015, 2016 being the warmest year ever, but it still didn't even sniff where they thought it was going to be. And we still don't see an end to cold records. We still don't see an end to snow records. In 2009 to 2011, the polar vortex was in position to pound Europe. In 2013 and 2014, the polar vortex was in the position to pound the United States. And the last 2 years, it's been in the position to pound Asia and the Middle East. The last 2 years, for the first time ever, and it's now happened twice in a row, it has dropped below freezing in parts of Taiwan that do not have heating in any part of that area. There's no need for them to have heating. It's a tropical country. They've never needed it before. And it's now been deadly cold twice in a row. Deadly cold has broken records in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in India. The people in Nepal were experiencing pretty darn cold weather as well, but it wasn't as deadly because they're used to it. Even as far to the west from there as Qatar and Yemen, Saudi Arabia, we've seen snow in the Sahara Desert now twice just this winter that is coming to an end right now in the Northern Hemisphere. Hadn't seen snow there in 40 years. We saw it with two separate storms just this winter. And so it's probably going to be moving back over to Europe and then, you know, cycling back around. That's sort of what it does. And the question is, well, all right, well, what is going on? Because in terms of the more intense tropical cyclone activity, the more intense wind, the stronger storms, and, you know, some of the heat days, some of the floods, some of the droughts, some of the extreme flash flood events, all of the other things that they said were going to happen with global warming are happening. It's just that the warming isn't as much as they thought, and it's not without the cold. It's almost like it's just become more extreme with the same amount of energy, so to speak. It's just it swings higher and it swings lower. That's basically what we have been seeing in terms of the global temperatures the last 20 years or so. And specifically, the sun was written off by officials as recently as 2012. That was when the IPCC issued their last written document, their official report, basically writing off the sun in terms of the climate change that we're all concerned about. And since that time, we are now approaching 400 peer-reviewed and published papers talking about how space weather and galactic cosmic rays really do have an influence. And it's everything from the things that had been written off before, reinterpreted, to the things that had never even been considered before, which would be some of the threshold events of space weather and the real role in galactic cosmic rays in modulating cloud cover.
What is a geomagnetic storm? Notable geomagnetic storms in history include the Carrington event, a major storm in 1859 that set fire to telegraph wires and shocked operators. You've mentioned this. You also mention in your book, in early 2016, the BART system in San Francisco encountered two mysterious power surges during a geomagnetic storm caused by a coronal hole stream, resulting in major failures. Now, when I read your book, these coronal holes in the sun seem to have quite an impact on Earth. Could you talk a little bit more about coronal holes?
Well, essentially what they are is there are areas where the magnetic fields of the sun don't loop from sun to sun, but they come out of the sun and they reach out and they grab onto something. They stretch all the way out past Pluto unless they connect to one of the planets or an asteroid or a comet or something like that. And it's not like it's a one giant tube. Kind of think of it the way you would how would I even describe this? If you can picture basically a million strings coming out of a sphere, you know, that would be about how small these magnetic fields would be. And even that is doing it a terrible, terrible disservice. It's just to sort of get you the idea that these things are not huge tubes. They're very, very small. And so right now the Earth probably has, you know, I don't know, dozens, hundreds, maybe thousands of individual connections with these interplanetary magnetic fields back to the sun. And these fields back to the sun connect at coronal holes. They're areas where these things called Alfvén waves come out and shoot through the solar system. And since the magnetic fields don't loop back down to the surface of the sun, they stream straight out. They allow the solar wind to stream out much faster as well. And every time a coronal hole faces Earth, a few things happen. For a few days, its strong interplanetary magnetic fields are interacting with our planet, and then it increases the intensity of the solar wind. And that usually can have some disruptive effects on Earth's magnetic field, cause those northern and southern lights, the auroras that I mentioned earlier.
The one solar event that we tend to hear about is the coronal mass ejection. Is this really less significant than some of the other activities of the sun?
Well, it's not that it's less significant. It's a part of the sun's activity. It's resulting from them. And so when there is a solar flare, the energy that comes out as X-rays is one thing. But when I said it can push those particles out, those electromagnetic particles out that hit the Earth as well, that is the CME. It's a coronal mass ejection. It is an ejection of mass from the corona, which is the atmosphere of the sun, usually triggered by a solar flare. And so that would be the other thing that can cause a geomagnetic storm, would be a CME. It's not the actual solar flare itself in most cases that causes the geomagnetic storm. It's the CME triggered by it.
Have there been published studies on space weather and human health? Are there ways to mitigate the risks? What are these health risks, and how would we know when the risks are high?
Well, I will go over to a handy dandy chart that I have made for discussions just such as this. So if you can envision something I've been talking about, you know, when the sun is not very active, we have these galactic cosmic rays, and that's not good. But when the sun is very, very active and there's a lot of solar flares and these are pounding the Earth, that's not very good either. There's a safe zone kind of in the middle, in an equilibrium, when the sun is sort of active. It's not really not really hammering Earth too bad, but it's still doing a pretty good job blocking out cosmic rays. That would be your safe zone for human health. And there have been there were dozens of studies done on this in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s in Russia, and it's really just starting to hit the ground now in the United States. Essentially, the risks are not that different, regardless of whether you're talking about a solar flare, a geomagnetic storm, or a cosmic ray event, because we're all talking about electromagnetic stress on our system. We're talking about acute myocardial infarction, cerebral stroke, heart rate fluctuations, all kinds of heart attacks, including terminal arrhythmia, acute coronary syndrome, increases in blood pressure, basically anything that involves the cardiac system. Over time, these can be factors in degenerative brain disease like dementia and Alzheimer's. This is what NASA is coming out and saying is the result of their studies from astronauts and things like that. Obviously, a lot of people know about the cataract risk and things like that, but not many know about the cancer risk even though it makes sense, it's electromagnetic radiation. And not many folks know about the cardiac risk. Over the short term, psychologically, everything from a flare-up in a psychological disorder to simple cognitive diminution, like you're reading a book or you're sitting in class and everything just kind of goes fuzzy, or you're driving in traffic and all of a sudden you go on autopilot, and maybe you're lucky enough to zone back in and say, whoa, it's a good thing I zoned back in. I haven't really been paying attention the last 10 minutes I've been driving. Things like that. Suicide risk goes up with these things. There's a radiation risk for people on airplanes. There's seizure risk. Migraines go up, especially during geomagnetic storms and solar flares, not as much during cosmic ray events. Flare-ups in everything, digestive disorders, skin conditions that are subject to flare-ups, those kind of things can follow some solar flare events. It's the kind of thing that has really broken open and really found its ground and is being studied on a number of different levels. And luckily, just as it was hitting the ground in the United States, this is back in 2002, and then another one followed in 2008, some fantastic literature reviews surveyed all of the old Russian work and really basically let U.S. researchers start much above the ground level when they began running with this. It's for the same reason that the sun can affect earthquakes and galactic cosmic rays can affect volcanoes. These things can affect our technology and these things can affect our bodies because, believe it or not, our bodies are very, very much electric. When you get down to the cellular level, almost everything is electric or polarity. It's as important, if not more important, than the organic chemistry itself. What elements are there? What molecules are there? And that's why this works. Now, in terms of how the last part of your question, how do we know if these things are going on? Well, you can keep an eye on space weather all the time. It sounds like it's difficult. It's really not that difficult. We have websites that let you do this. In the morning news show that we put out every day, we discuss exactly what space weather is doing, whether or not there's any geomagnetic storms or cosmic ray alerts. And we also have the Disaster Prediction app, which is now officially the fastest geomagnetic storm notifier, faster than both NASA's top physicist and the official government alerts from NOAA. The fastest geomagnetic storm alerts in any app in the world. It also beats their email alerts. And that's also where we issue our cosmic ray health alerts. And those do not exist anywhere else in the world except for our app.
I'm speaking with independent researcher and author Ben Davidson. Today's show, Space Weather and Earthquakes. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. How would a person get your disaster prediction application?
Well, unfortunately, if they have a Windows phone, they're a little bit out of luck. It is available on Apple and Android only right now, and it is called the Disaster Prediction app. It is by Space Weather News. If you have trouble finding it on your app store, you can just go to spaceweathernews.com, and there's a button for the Google store page and the Apple store page. Of course, it would be helpful to do that on your phone so you actually, get to the iTunes page where you're going to use it, or your iPad. It works on the iPad as well. But truly, if you take that 1 hour I mentioned earlier and you click "What is space weather?" up at the top of spaceweathernews.com, you'll be able to just use the free website, spaceweathernews.com, anytime you want to look. Now, granted, it might slip your mind. You might not watch for a couple of days. If you would want, the kind of thing where you want to be notified when something is happening and you don't want to be bothered with learning about the physics and going and checking the website every day to make sure that you're not under some kind of health alert. Okay, the app costs $3, and it's well worth it because it's not just that, but it's where our earthquake risk maps are posted as well. We haven't even talked about that, have we?
Well, that was my very next question, Ben, and that's a very important one. You just launched the Earthquake Prediction Center. What is it, and what do you hope to do with it? How successful have you been at predicting earthquakes?
Here's the short version of the story. So in 2015, I thought I noticed a pattern between the sun and large earthquakes. I went to a NASA engineer, and he noticed the pattern too, and he thought he could explain it. We went to a statistics professor from The Ohio State University to say, hey, can you prove that this actually is a pattern and we're not crazy? We think we can explain it if it's real, but we'd like to know if it's real first. And he agreed to the point where he put his name on the peer-reviewed paper with us. That really led us down the line to really where we are today, which is not absolute earthquake alerts like hurricane forecasts are, but of the total global fault system where an earthquake could happen pretty much anywhere at any time. We know chances are if one's going to happen, it'll probably be in the Ring of Fire, but you know, we still probably get 25 to 40% of the big earthquakes every year outside of that area. So it's sort of a crapshoot, and at the moment, there is no official recognized pattern to earthquakes, except that since October 15th, 2016, that would be just this last fall, when the full current model went into real-world, real-time operation, and in the practice period before that as well, that global fault area can be reduced to between 10 to 20% of itself. So we're talking about tiny areas. Sometimes that 10 to 20% is, you know, one coastline of a continent like Chile, Peru, and Ecuador. Or sometimes it's broken up into, you know, maybe just a few hundred kilometer segments in a couple of different places. But that 10 to 20% is capturing more than 80% of the magnitude 6 and higher earthquakes. And that's really when things, you know, start to get dangerous. That's when buildings come down. That's when people die. And when you get much larger than that, that's when tsunamis occur. And so since October 15th, 2016, there have been 30 of those events, that are magnitude 6 and higher, you know, above 6.0 baseline, that are also considered significant because they are close enough to the crust to be felt. You know, if we get a 6.2 and it's 100 kilometers down, it's maybe not as significant. And so there have been 30 of those real significant events, the 30 big ones since last October. 24 of those have hit our high alert zones, and those high alert zones have averaged 17.9%. So on average, we're putting about 17.9% of the globe on alert, but we're getting about 80 to 83% of the biggest earthquakes.
What are some of the recent earthquakes that your Earthquake Prediction Center has been able to predict?
Well, on October 29th, the only time our highest alert, which we call an alert star, we put a giant star on the map over the area, the only time an alert star of ours has ever appeared outside of the Ring of Fire, only happened once, was October 29th, 2016, and it was over the country of Italy. Many people know that on October 30th, just one day later, a 6.6 struck that area. It took down the Basilica of St. Benedict, and it was the largest earthquake that has hit there in decades and decades. The only six-pointer that has hit the United States during this period was a 6.6 that struck on December 8th. The United States will get what we would refer to as a yellow alert or an orange alert every once in a while. That's not wholly uncommon, but a red alert in the United States is very uncommon. But the red alert in the United States began December 6th, was confirmed December 7th, and the morning of December 8th, a few hours before the 6.6 did end up striking the Mendocino Junction offshore of California. Luckily, that one was offshore and a few kilometers deep, plus the ocean. And so that one was felt by some people in the Golden Triangle, but there wasn't really any damage. There have been no eight-pointers since the model began running. However, there have been a number of very large quakes, and for those who are looking to get more information on this, they can go to quakewatch.net, and at the bottom of the page, the left button is the model, stats, and information. Essentially, there have been two 7.9s, two 7.8s, a 7.6, and a 7.3, and that's all. There have been six 7-pointers since the model began. Only one of them was not in the alert zone. Both 7.9s struck Papua New Guinea. They were in the alert zone. The 7.8 that caused a tsunami in New Zealand, it's being called the most complex earthquake in modern history. That one was also in an alert zone. There was a 7.8 that struck the Solomon Islands that missed an alert zone by a few hundred kilometers. I know that's very close, but when it's out, it's out. One hit Chile and one hit the Philippines as well. Basically, everywhere except the Middle East, we have had success with this. Every six-pointer that has struck Japan since October 15th has struck an alert zone. Every single six-pointer that has struck Chile, Argentina, or Bolivia has hit the alert zone. We had the only one that struck the Middle East was a 6.6 in Tajikistan. And actually, I'm sorry, there was one other one in Pakistan that we did get, so we have had success there. But the biggest one was in Tajikistan, a 6.6, and we took the region off alert 72 minutes before the event happened. We learned some harsh lessons that day, removing a red line in the middle of the desert in the Middle East, and then about an hour later they get a 6.6. We really felt bad about that one, but we also felt we learned a lot from that as well. We do unfortunately end up needing to fail in order to make progress and learn, which with people's lives at risk, that's a tough pill to swallow sometimes.
There was a significant earthquake several years ago in Nepal. I don't remember the year. Are you aware of that earthquake? And was your app up and running then?
Oh, it was not. The app went into operation on December 20th, just last year. And so the model began running before the app did. And so the model has been available for people on Twitter and on the website for people to see. But now it posts first to the app, and then I take screenshots of the app and I repost those on Twitter for people. But the actual model and links to all of the, you know, publicly timestamped by Twitter and preserved forecasts is on quakewatch.net as well. Those links are all still active. They've all still got their Twitter timestamps, so you can, you know, see when that map was posted, and then you can go see when the earthquake occurred and see, hey, yep, the times match up. No funny business there. That's something really important that forecasters don't always do. They don't always give people a way to verify what they've done. And I have found difficulty getting through to academia due to my use of Twitter, but it's publicly timestamped. It's not like Twitter can be hacked and you can go in and change things. And with 18,000 followers, people are retweeting everything. Even if I delete something, the record of what I've done is there. People are retweeting it all the time. And I don't know if you know this, but just because you delete a tweet, it doesn't delete the retweets and the other things like that. So I thought Twitter was perfect because you can't cheat. It was likely to be seen with you know, tens of thousands of people. But, you know, as you might imagine, university professors and government folks weren't really looking at Twitter and thinking much of it. So the model has really just started just this fall. The first official presentation of the model hasn't even occurred yet. It will occur April 8th and 9th at a conference called Observing the Frontier It's going to be in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It is sold out. It's been sold out for a while, but they're going to be recording the presentations and putting the audio to the slides and the PowerPoints and everything else that is being shown. So that will be hitting the public airwaves soon. The goal is not to patent this. The goal is not to try to get through to academia. I did everything I could for as long as I could, and their stubbornness has about met my own. So I've decided that the better thing to do, since people who watch my show, people who just spend a few minutes on the websites, they start predicting earthquakes themselves. Since I've since a kid got a scholarship to his top choice university after writing an essay on this topic, since I got a 12-year-old to predict four six-pointers in a row, I think I can teach just about anybody to do this. And the goal is, you know, we've got QuakeWatch.net, we've got the app, and the tools to teach and allow you to do this in real time are starting to be put there. If you go to QuakeWatch.net/Prediction Center, you're going to find the first tool is actually already up in there. It combines our number one subterranean signal with our number one atmospheric signal. And the earthquakes we're looking for happen in between those two. I don't want to go through it. There's a pretty good explanation on the site. But the idea is to share that presentation that's happening at that conference publicly and then continue just dumping information every time I figure something out or somebody figures something out. Just keep dumping that information to the point where before we know it, we've got thousands of people being able to predict the next earthquake. And before too long, we are going to have a very good grasp on what's going to happen when and where. Because so far, it's really just been in my hands and the hands of the folks who are, you know, the most diligent observers of what I do and the folks who take the time to go to the websites and really dig in a bit deeper. The moment this gets truly open source and, you know, people can pick it up and improve it like the way open source was meant to be, I'll be more than happy to sit back in a rocking chair and watch the world start really giving warnings to people before these deadly seismic events occur.
I'm speaking with independent researcher and author Ben Davidson. Today's show, Space Weather and Earthquakes. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Could you talk about how the sun triggers large earthquakes?
Well, absolutely. You know, we have this constant magnetic, this constant electric interaction between the Earth and the sun. And when people are looking for a connection between the Earth and sun, they're always either looking for sunspots, or they're looking at the solar wind, or they're looking at solar flares, or they're looking at those geomagnetic storms. And what they fail to realize is that those things aren't going to be the things that are going to be primary in earthquake triggering, because those are small scale by comparison to the interplanetary magnetic fields of coronal holes. I mean, the smallest coronal hole dwarfs the largest sunspot. The interplanetary magnetic fields from coronal holes will literally grab onto a planet and create a direct plasma exchanging connection between that planet and the sun. It's the only thing that gets to bypass Earth's magnetic field, the solar flares, the cosmic rays, the solar wind. All of those things have to contend with Earth's magnetic field. And yeah, sometimes they're able to disrupt it and cause a geomagnetic storm. But the interplanetary magnetic field does not have to worry about Earth's shield. It is a direct connection. And when you think about how much metal, how much crystal, how much water, I don't know if you heard about this, but there is more than the entire Earth's oceans worth of water trapped beneath the ground that we can't see. All of these things are conductive. They're subject to magnetism. They're subject to electric currents. And, you know, whether that's iron, whether that's olivine, whether that's crystals, water, We're talking about a direct magnetic connection on large scales, the kind that can move continents, the kind that can move plates. And the way it does this is by electricity. The same thing that we mentioned before. You know, this is very hard to do if you don't, if you can't visualize it. But the electricity on Earth, we think of it as just the lightning. But the lightning is sort of just a static discharge, like whenever you get shocked because you've dragged your socks on the carpet and you touched the metal door handle. That's not really a system. That's not really a flow. But that flow does indeed exist on Earth in fair weather, high pressure, clear skies. The currents come down to the ground. They go back up in storms. Sometimes those currents won't make it to the ground. Sometimes they'll hit ambient clouds, juice them up. Sometimes when they come down to the ground, they won't be encountering the surface tension of the ocean or the telluric currents of the crust, but they'll be encountering a fault line, in which case path of least resistance says, let's go deep. We have aligned layers of crystals. Well, crystals are not going to let current pass, so it's going to sort of funnel it sideways around. Well, where are the storms? Because that's where we might look for that energy to come back up out of the Earth. We know it's got to get back up to the top of the sky anyway. We know it can only get there through the storms. Well, okay, well, what path is that going to take from the high pressure to the low pressure? And so what we can do is, and this was the case with the call on the California earthquake. The day before that event happened, the morning that event happened, we had described how the other red alert that day, sitting in the middle of China, had got struck by a 6.0 because it was facing the sun when a coronal hole solar wind stream arrived. And we had said that if there is another stream and it happens to be when the United States is facing the sun, then we might have to be concerned, especially because there was a low pressure system, a storm, a good solid one right off the Mendocino Junction. The incoming solar energy from the solar wind was coming directly down onto the United States, and there was a massive high pressure cell over most of the country. So high pressure, you know, from sky to the ground. And it was clear that the sister system to that high pressure cell was the low that was off of California. And so we have this introduction, this pushing of Earth's magnetic field, the Van Allen belts, and the global electric circuit increasing the energy down onto the Earth that day, down onto the United States that day. Now, for the 3 days previous to that, we had seen increasingly strong earthquakes migrating from inland California towards that storm that was sitting offshore. The last of those four shocks actually was offshore near where the 6.6 ended up happening and was triggered as the next solar wind stream hit Earth. Within an hour, the 6.6 came out basically where the storm was. It was a perfect solar system circuit event where we saw energy from the sun slam the Earth, and twice in a row. I mean, it was sort of a double stream. It hit once during the daylight in China and hit once during the daylight in the United States. And both times we saw that energy come in high pressure. We saw four shocks build towards a low pressure, and we saw big earthquakes occur towards those low pressure systems. Luckily in China, nobody lives where that one happened. In the United States, some people felt it, but didn't cause any damage. That's the kind of thing I love to see, when we can get a perfect example of the sun influencing Earth's own electrical system and nobody dies and not a building is, you know, has a crack in its wall or its foundation or something like that. Those are the days I live for.
With regard to your upcoming conference in early April, Observing the Frontier in Albuquerque, New Mexico, who are some of your speakers?
Well, we are proud to once again have Dr. Pierre-Marie Robitaille of The Ohio State University. He is not the statistics professor that we went to there, but he is one of the top folks in their radiology department. And if his name is sounding familiar to anyone, it might be because modern MRI machines are what they are because of him. If you've had something that a doctor found because of an MRI, or maybe surgery to repair a knee or a shoulder went well because the doctor knew exactly what he was looking for when he went in there, we can thank Dr. Robitaille. And, you know, that goes to any tumors or anything else found in an MRI or anything like that. Essentially, when he wanted to put 8 Tesla magnets into MRI machines, they said, "You're going to fry people's brains." And he said, "No, I'm not, and here's why." And he proved that he was correct, and now this is how MRIs work. Well, what do you do apart from just sort of sit back, have your position at the university, when you've basically rewritten a piece of physics? You take a look at what else that incorrect piece of physics has been applied to. And it turns out that incorrect piece of physics that he fixed to get us to the MRI machine that we have today is what is necessary to think the sun is a gas instead of a liquid, to think the microwave background is a signature of the Big Bang, and a number of other fundamental cosmological things just like that. And he is going to be talking about the nature of stars and the nature of water, which we are very, very excited about. Dr. Michael Claridge is a member of the Sapphire Project and a frequent contributor to the Thunderbolts Project. He is going to be giving 2 presentations. One is going to be much more of his standard electromagnetic physics type presentations, and the other, we do expect a Sapphire update, their attempts to create the electric sun. So that'll be fun. Eugene Bagashoff is coming, and he's going to be talking about magnetic vorticity. I really hope that has to do with tornadoes, because I think that could be really, really interesting, although I'm not entirely sure what he's going to talk about. I've got Dave Talbot from the Thunderbolts Project. We're going to be doing a live interview, and I'm going to be asking him some very difficult questions. I'm not going to surprise him. He knows what's coming, but not easy questions to answer. And Adrian D'Amico from the Suspect Sky YouTube channel and I are going to be doing that as well on topics that are more his realm. Tony Rango is going to be there giving an electric geology report. Really, really couldn't be prouder of Tony for attempting to fill this gaping chasm of a void filled when Michael Steinbacher left us last year. Really almost no way to describe how big of a hit that was to the electric terraforming and the electric geology world. And Tony, thankfully, is going to continue his efforts in bringing that back, keeping it alive, et cetera. I will be giving a number of talks as well, although it's really just one presentation broken up into 3 different segments. One is the results of the earthquake forecasting. 2 is why it works and how it works. And 3 is really teaching folks how to go out there and do this themselves.
You do a short show every single morning, 6 a.m. Eastern. Are those daily shows archived?
Absolutely. Absolutely. All of those shows are archived. Every morning since 2011, we have put out a 5 to 6 minute update on what the sun is doing, how it's affecting the weather, earthquakes. Sometimes we'll throw in some interesting space news if it's there to be had as well. Those can all be found on YouTube, and a specific archive of them can be found on spaceweathernews.com as well. In the menu bar, just click Solar News Archive. Or Solar Archive, I think it says.
Ben Davidson, thank you so much again.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure.
And good luck at Observing the Frontier.
Thank you very much.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is, ain't exactly.
exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Ben Davidson. Today's show has been Space Weather and Earthquakes. Ben Davidson is an independent researcher into the science of climate change. Be sure to tune in next week when Ben Davidson will spend the hour discussing magnetic pole reversals on both the Earth and the Sun. He will talk about the effects of two things that are coming together to create increased cloud cover, which will decrease temperatures and debunk the greenhouse effect. He will also discuss how the melting of the poles is actually one of the triggers of an ice age. Visit his websites at suspiciousobservers.org. That's suspiciousobservers.org with a zero instead of the letter O. Also visit earthchanges.org and spaceweathernews.com. Follow Ben Davidson on Twitter at TheRealSOS. That's TheRealSOS. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, EG. And a new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? So wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit sniper trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying? Look what's inside yourself for peace. Give thanks, live life, and release. You dig me? You got me?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Is Water the New Oil? Part 2, with Dr. Seth Darling, plus a satiric song by Tom Lehrer. I hope you'll stay tuned. Last week, we heard about the new mineral shortage of the 21st century, fresh water. It's long past time to get serious about conserving and protecting this vital resource, Dr. Seth Darling says. Water that's clean and pure enough to drink will be in ever shorter supply per capita. So, just as a start, maybe we shouldn't use pure drinking water to flush our toilets or spray on our lawns. We've been squandering fresh, clean water because, in the 20th century, water was abundant, safe, and cheap. Remember those three qualities: abundant, safe, and cheap. In the 21st century, we can have any two of the three, but not the third. We can have abundant and safe, but not cheap, safe and cheap, but not abundant, or abundant and cheap, but not safe. Choose your poison, as they say. But today, Darling takes an optimistic tack. He talks about purification techniques, some cutting-edge science at Argonne National Laboratory, and the huge and successful water projects done in Chicago over the last 130 years. We'll hear the rest of Darling's talk, then some relevant music by Tom Lehrer, and then a bit of Darling's Q&A. Forward we go.
As I said, we all feel like water should be cheap or maybe even free. But there's this great quote from Ben Franklin: when the well is dry, we learn the worth of water. Okay, so you came to hear some science. What is water? So that's water. What's the chemical formula for water? H2O. It's the one molecule everybody knows. But maybe there's something you didn't know about water. So this is what the molecule looks like. The O, oxygen, is the red guy in the middle. And the H, the two hydrogens, are on the two sides. What's important about this molecule is the way it's shaped. Those two hydrogen atoms are not in a straight line with the oxygen, with one on each side. They're both on the same side, like Mickey Mouse ears. And that's a really important thing about water, because oxygen likes negative charge more than the hydrogen does. And so the electrons that are flying around that molecule distribute themselves asymmetrically. There's more electrons on one side than on the other side. And so you get something called polarity, where the molecule is more positive over here and more negative over here. And that one aspect of water, the fact that it's polar, controls so many of the things, the interesting and important properties about water. For one thing, that's what allows microwave ovens to work. The reason they work is the microwaves come through and they cause those polar molecules to rotate and vibrate around, and that's what heats up your food. More importantly, water's polarity is what drives proteins to fold. So the proteins that make up you and me and every living thing on Earth are folded up in very complex ways, these big molecules. And all of those folding interactions are mediated by water. If it were not polar, this would not happen. There would be no life. Another strange thing about water's polarity is that it causes solid water, ice, to be less dense than liquid water, water. That is really unusual for a material. There are only a handful of examples of all the materials in the world that we know of where this is true, and water is one of them. That's why ice floats in your glass of water, because it's less dense than the water. And the same thing happens on Lake Michigan in the winter. This is important, that when it freezes in the winter, it freezes at some of the water, that ice sits on the top because it's less dense, and that serves as an insulating barrier to keep the entire lake from freezing during the winter, so you can have life in that water year-round. Again, without that, we might not have life on Earth at all. Another thing about water's polarity is that it makes it a fantastic solvent. Polar molecules are really good at dissolving stuff. So you can put all kinds of different things into water, and it'll stay there. And that is also really important for us. Pictured here in the background, way too small for you to see, is just a piece of the metabolism that happens inside our bodies. There are thousands and thousands, probably millions, of different chemicals inside us, going through all kinds of different chemical reactions all the time inside our cells. And all of them are dissolved in water. That's the solvent. So all of those things need to be dissolved by just one thing. But the fact that it's a great solvent has an unfortunate side effect, which means it's very easy to pollute. It can dissolve the stuff we want, but it also dissolves all kinds of stuff you don't want to stay in the water. Heavy metals, all those micropollutants I was talking about, and plenty of other things. Once they get in the water, they stay in the water. Okay, so that's some bad. A good news piece of water is that you can't use up water. The water that's on Earth has been here since long before we were here, and it'll be here long after we're all gone. There are still competing theories about where all the water came from originally on Earth. Extraterrestrial sources are recognized as probably one of the significant original sources, but that all happened way early in our planet's history, and that water just keeps going around through a cycle, right? You learned about this in grade school, where water evaporates, and then it rains down, and it just keeps going through a cycle. So it's the same water. What that means is that every molecule of water in every glass that you drink has at some point in its life been inside an oak tree, been blasted out by a volcano, and it's been urinated by a dinosaur. Which sounds gross, that we're all drinking dinosaur pee. But what that actually tells you is another important thing about water, which is that no matter how dirty you make it, it can always be cleaned again. It doesn't matter what you put in that water, you can get it back out again if you put in the right effort. So, clean water. What does that mean, to say water is clean? That's actually a really complicated question because, as I said, you can put all kinds of different things into water. And you might say, well, let's just take it all out, so all that's left is H2O. You don't want that. You don't want to drink that. That's actually poison, pure, pure water. It'll leach out nutrients from your body. You don't want it to be that clean. The point is, you want the water to be the appropriate cleanliness for the application that it's going to be used. If you're going to drink it, you want it to be pretty clean. You don't want viruses or heavy metals or certain things in there. But you do need some minerals to be in there, like I said, so it's actually not unhealthy to drink. There are other things where the water can be dirtier. If you're just going to water your lawn, it doesn't need to be drinking water quality. Or, on the flip side, if you're going to manufacture semiconductors, like what's inside your smartphones and laptops and all that, you do need that water to be ultra, ultra clean, cleaner than drinking water. In fact, much cleaner than drinking water. So, in fact, the most state-of-the-art water purification plants in the world are at semiconductor manufacturing. So the idea here is you make the right water for the right purpose. It's called fit for use. And again, the ancient Romans did this a long time ago. It's time to start doing it again. So how do you clean water? There are lots of ways to clean water. This is just a few examples. There are more. So one way is you can do media filtration. This is an old school technique. You basically have a big barrel of sand, and you just pour your dirty water over the top and let it come out the bottom. And it's not the sand per se that's doing the cleaning. On the sand grows a biofilm with lots of little bacteria and stuff in it that chew up a lot of the bad stuff that's in the water. So as it percolates through, it gets cleaned up. What happens in most of our municipal plants is that mouthful up at the top there, coagulation, flocculation, sedimentation, filtration, which I won't go through the time to describe what that whole process is, but that's how most of our municipal water gets cleaned. Under your kitchen sink, you might have something that looks like that picture over on the right-hand side, membrane filtration. And in fact, that's an area where most of the exciting research, at least in my view, in water technology is these days, is in membrane filtration. I think there are great opportunities to push that technology forward. Other techniques that are out there are things like distillation. This is where you basically boil the water and then recondense it, and then it comes out much cleaner than it was before and leaves behind all the impurities. And you can also disinfect water just to get rid of the pathogens. You can do that with chlorination, dumping in chlorine. That's what we do in most of our municipal systems. You can also do it with ultraviolet light, like what's pictured there, which in some places in the developing world is also used in municipal water treatment systems. So this brings me back to the issue of our oceans. I told you We don't have a water shortage. It's just that most of it is in the oceans. We do know how to take seawater and make fresh water. It's a process called desalination, and it's come a long way. People have gotten pretty good at desalination. But I want to give you a sense for the scale of the problem here. This is a plot of the global capacity for desalination by year. So the units here are millions of cubic meters per day that are processed in desalination. And you can see every year the capacity grows. We're building more and more desalination plants. So that's great. And it's maybe not surprising the countries that are leading the way here are places like Israel and United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia and places that are near salt water and are very dry. But let me tell you the scale of the problem here. Look where we are today. Top of that scale is 140 in these units, right? So I'm going to take that graph and I'm just going to squish it down. That's our global water use. So you can see how far we have to go if we're going to try and use this to solve our problem. That's not going to get us out of this mess anytime soon. An awful long way to go. Okay. So you may not realize, but here in Chicagoland, we actually have a long history of very impressive water engineering. Long time ago, if you walked out on the streets of Chicago back in the 1800s, it was a really gross place to be. There was sewage on the streets, horse manure and so on. Just, it was awful. And for a city aspiring to be a growing metropolitan center, that was not acceptable. So the idea would be water sanitation. You want to put that sewage into sewer lines instead of just out on the street. The problem with Chicago is that because of the soil conditions, you couldn't dig under the buildings and put in sewer lines. It wasn't feasible. So what did Ellis Chesbrough do? He thought, well, I'm going to give Chicago the first sewer system in the United States. No city had it before this. And crazy thought, he said, all right, we can't go under the city. Let's lift up the city. And that's actually what they did. They put jacks under all the buildings and jacked them up and built the sewers underneath. Unbelievable. But they did it, and it worked. So that solved one problem, because now the sewage wasn't on the streets anymore. But you know where those sewers dumped? Into the Chicago River. Where did the Chicago River go? Into Lake Michigan. That's where our drinking water was coming from. Still is coming from. So we were just dumping raw sewage into our drinking water, and people started getting sick. So you might think, well, let's just dump our sewage somewhere else, but no, no, not in Chicago. They said, we're just going to make the Chicago River go the other way. And that's what they did. They actually came in and reversed the flow of the Chicago River, dumped a lot of that nasty stuff into what's now the Sanitarian Ship Canal, which actually runs right by Argonne National Laboratory, and, you know, solved the problem, so to speak. But our great water engineering didn't stop there. There's a more recent example at an even larger scale, I would say. So we have this other problem in Chicago that our sewer system is called a combined system, where we use the same lines to handle what comes out of our house as waste and what goes down the storm drains. For those who've lived in Chicago a long time, you're familiar with when there's a big storm, you get too much water going into that system for the treatment plant to handle, and the whole thing backs up, and it comes up in your basement as untreated sewage, which is not fun for anyone who's experienced it. So enough taxpayers finally got fed up with this that they created what you've probably heard of as the deep tunnel, although maybe you've never seen pictures of it. The official name for it is the Tunnel and Reservoir Plan, or TARP plan. But there's this network of tunnels that are massive. Look at the scale here. That's a guy, to give you a sense for how big this tunnel is. And there's a whole bunch of these things under our city which handle this massive flow when there's a big storm that the treatment plant can't handle as fast as it's coming in. And all those tunnels then dump out into places like this. This is Thornton Quarry. Look at the scale here again. Those are trucks. The people there, you can't even see. They're so tiny. That's, I think, the tri-state right up there at the top. This is the largest such reservoir in the world, I believe. So all that water gets tunneled down, dumped into there, and it'll sit there until the treatment plants can catch up and process all that mess and get you back to the normal state of affairs. So we've been thinking about big-scale water engineering in Chicago essentially as long as there's been a Chicago. Let me bring it home a little more, though, to Argonne. There is a sizable but rapidly growing program in water research at Argonne which very much is in partnership with the University of Chicago, in fact, principally through the Institute for Molecular Engineering, which is a joint institute between these two great research organizations. So just a few examples of the sort of types of work that are going on in water. One would be, I told you a little earlier about how important policy is, things like virtual water not being policed really at all today. The policymakers need to have the right information to understand what policies to put into place, and that's something that smart scientists and engineers can provide. We're also looking at connections between water and the environment in many ways, and food. So top three challenges we face as a society are energy, water, and food. And they're all connected with each other. It's not just a water-energy nexus, it's a water-energy-food nexus. We can get a lot smarter, so you guys answered correctly about where most of our water is used, not withdrawn. Most of it's withdrawn for the power plants, but most of it is used for agriculture. So that's where, if you're going to try and save some water, that's a good place to turn. And we're not very smart about the way we water our crops. We basically just dump water across an entire farm, more or less the same. What you can do instead is something called site-specific crop management, or precision agriculture, where you go in and you deliver just the right amount of water to even each plant, and just at the right spot by its roots. The Israelis are really good at this already. This is something that we're learning much more about. Another interesting topic of research at Argonne is groundwater dating. So I told you earlier about groundwater and fossil water and how a lot of it's been down there for a really long time. How do you know how long that water's been down there to know how quickly an aquifer is getting replenished? It's actually a really hard question to answer. So the way that we're trained in school that you date old things is carbon dating, right? That's what's used for old human artifacts. Carbon dating doesn't work for things that are hundreds of thousands or even millions of years old. You need some other technique. And so at Argonne, they've developed something called atom trap trace analysis to use krypton dating. And they've actually gone and started dating different aquifers, and they can tell you this one is, 600,000 years old, and that one is 200,000 years old. Really important information. We're also developing all kinds of advanced materials technologies to tackle problems of pollution. In my own group, we're doing things to, for example, clean up oil spills with some advanced materials, and developing, I told you, membranes are where most of the exciting new water technology is coming. We're developing all kinds of advanced membrane technologies at Argonne that clean themselves and effectively filter out pathogens and all kinds of other things. Okay. So we face a lot of huge societal challenges. There's climate change, there's income inequality in our financial system, and so on and so forth. A lot of these big challenges, it's really hard to muster affection for them. The financial system, and maybe the University of Chicago is the wrong place to say this, but it's really hard to muster affection about the financial system. Our affection for water is something that we're born with. We are all so connected to water that people love water. It is who we are, literally. And water's invisibility, I said, is bad for us and for water. The fact that we have this innate affection for it is good for us and for water. And we need to start reevaluating water's importance. It's important for our foreign policy, our food, the environment around us, public health, our national security, and as I told you, it's intimately connected to energy. It connects to our lives in so many different ways. So water may be invisible, but I would encourage you to start seeing water. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Time was when an American about to go abroad would be warned by his friends or the guidebooks not to drink the water. But times have changed, and now a foreigner coming to this country might be offered the following advice.
Visit American City, you will find it very pretty. Just two things of which you must beware: don't drink the water and don't breathe the air. Pollution, pollution, they got smog and sewage and mud. Turn on your tap and get hot and cold running crud. The halibuts and the sturgeons are being wiped out by detergents. Fish gotta swim and birds gotta fly, but they don't last long if they try. Pollution, pollution, you can use the latest toothpaste and then rinse your mouth with industrial waste. Just Just go out for a breath of air, and you'll be ready for Medicare. The city streets are really quite a thrill. If the hoods don't get you, the monoxide will. Pollution, pollution, wear a gas mask and a veil. Then you can breathe, long as you don't inhale. Lots of things there that you can drink, but stay away from the kitchen sink, the breakfast garbage that you throw into the bay. They drink at lunch in San Jose. So go to the city, see the crazy people there, like lambs to the slaughter. They're drinking the water and breathing the air.
Tom Lehrer with a song from 1965, Pollution, reminding us how little has changed in the past 50 years. Now, fast forward to 2016. Here's a bit of the Q&A following Darling's talk.
I was aware of the technology of desalination, but I'm concerned. How is that economically feasible? And what do you think about the future to make it more economically feasible for poor countries in Africa and South Asia?
Okay, so desalination. So I mentioned one thing is that we've got a long way to go with it in terms of scale, right? So it's very important in places like Israel, for example, but globally the scale is essentially irrelevant at this point. So let me talk about technology and science first with desalination. So you can calculate by just the laws of physics, thermodynamics, how much energy it takes to take the salt out of seawater to give you drinking water. It's some amount of energy. And it used to be, you know, a few decades ago, that the desalination technology was a long way away from that limit. When they would use, there are still plants operating in places like Saudi Arabia that essentially do distillation. It's very energy intensive. But the state-of-the-art plants, reverse osmosis plants, which is what people are building today, are so good that they're actually approaching those fundamental limits and how efficient it could ever be. So there's actually no breakthrough coming in energy savings for desalination. And by the way, that is what limits how much you can desalinate. You talk about the cost. That's where the cost is primarily, is in the energy to build up the pressure to shove the salt water through those membranes and get the salt out. And energy just costs money. So there's no breakthrough coming there. It's never going to get a lot cheaper than it is today. It'll get a little bit cheaper as people get a little better at it, but there's no breakthrough there. What I just said is true for seawater, but the story changes for brackish water, which is less salty water. And there's a lot of brackish water on Earth in aquifers, for example. Many places where there's fossil fuels, there's also water, but the water's a little salty. Not as salty as seawater, but it's too salty to drink. And desalinating that, there's all kinds of exciting technological innovations that are yet to be made. There's all kinds of room for improvement there. So don't give up on desalination altogether. I'm just saying there's not a breakthrough in seawater desalination. In terms of cost, the Israelis pay more for water than we do because it's expensive to desalinate because of the energy. And there's really no way around that. What I would argue, though, is we're not actually paying as much for water here as we should be. There's not really intelligent water pricing much of anywhere on Earth today, which I tried to allude to a few times. That will help us start making smarter decisions with how we use water if it has an appropriate price on it. The flip side of that is you can argue that water is a human right. You can't charge people for water if they can't afford to buy enough to live. That's inhuman. And so how do you balance those two things? And there's another issue. Adam Smith's Invisible Hand, University of Chicago, we can talk about this, that, you know, uses market forces to try and solve your problem. So you come up with a price, and you say that's the price, and then let the market solve your problem. But all that does is make sure that we humans share our water in a certain way that maybe makes sense. The problem is we're not the only ones who need water. The ecosystem around us needs water, too. The rest of the Earth needs a lot of water to grow the trees and all the other things that happen on Earth that need water, all the other organisms. And they don't pay water bills. So there has to be another hand that comes in with Adam Smith's invisible hand, a green hand, if you will, that represents, you know, the Lorax, speaks for the trees.
I have a question for you. Who cares? You know, so we, you know, you've alluded to the crisis that we've all heard about in Flint, the World Health Organization came out with a statement that reverse osmosis systems are actually really bad in their current form, perhaps, for health. And in fact, there are stories out there of children drinking formula based on reverse osmosis systems who actually got really sick. The city of Chicago school system finally came out and said, oh, no, we haven't been testing for lead. So my question is, and who cares? So you've been in this field. Can you tell us who cares?
Yeah, well, that's you're all here because you care, right? So this is something we're trying to spread the word about, is the importance of water. That's why I'm up here talking and why I give other talks just like this, is that I think you're right, that this is a crisis that certainly the folks of Flint are feeling acutely right now, but in other parts of the world, as I mentioned, children are dying every day because they're consuming water that's not been cleaned, and that should not be acceptable to any of us. And that is a crisis of leadership, but who elects those leadership? That's us. So it's all of our fault. It's all of our responsibility to fix this.
Scientist Seth Darling, speaking at the University of Chicago on May 18, 2016. I have gently edited and slightly condensed the original audio recording. And for sending that original recording our way, let us thank again non-commercial radio guy Dale Lehman, out Windy City way. Tempus fugit, and so must we. If you missed part one of Darling's talk, or any other show of ours, you can grab it on MP3 from our website, which is, and I quote, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. Illegitimi non carborundum, let's try to live each day as though the truth were true, and, as Mom used to say, I'd be tickled pink if you tuned in again next week. Ciao.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
of truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. People often say to me, if 9/11 really was a false flag attack done by members of our own government with the help of other countries' intelligence agencies, then why wouldn't anyone speak out about it? On today's show, you'll hear a CIA whistleblower, Kevin Shipp, talk about 9/11, climate engineering, vaccines, and the persecution of truth tellers, and why most government employees won't speak out. This speech was given at a conference in Northern California and published on YouTube on October 10th, 2016. Kevin Shipp frequently refers to Dane in the speech, and by this he's referring to Dane Wigington of geoengineeringwatch.org, who has been very outspoken about chemtrails and climate engineering. Kevin Shipp recently published a book called In the Company of Shadows. And here he is, former CIA agent and whistleblower Kevin Shipp, sharing his inside knowledge from working at the CIA.
I always like to start out by saying I'm a recovering CIA officer. If you all that were here this morning, I do go to weekly meetings, Agency Anonymous, so I'm getting there. I was a decorated CIA officer. That part of that is in the book, which we fought to get out. Initially, they told me I could never say I worked there. We fought them, and we beat them on that one, and we got some things in the book eventually. I went on deadly assignments for my agency and my country. I loved my country. I was very dedicated to the agency. Some of those assignments, they told us we may not come back from. No problem. That's what we did. But the higher I got up in the agency, the more I begin to see illegal, unconstitutional, sometimes criminal activity that the agency and some other sectors of the shadow government, I call it, were doing things that were illegal and unconstitutional. And I always have to say this. The United States Constitution is the supreme law of the land. It supersedes every other law in the U.S. criminal justice system and the judicial branch. That's worth remembering. When the U.S. government violates the Constitution, they are committing multiple felonies based on the foundation of our government. We must always remember that. So, as a federal agent, I had to swear an oath to the Constitution to defend the Constitution and our country against enemies, foreign and domestic. The problem was there were some that were domestic, and there were some that happened to be in our own government. So I had to make a decision. Was I going to uphold my oath to the Constitution, or was I going to shrink back? And for me, there it was an easy choice. I chose to stand for the Constitution, and that's why I'm here this evening. We have to. If it's because we have been so busy with our lives, just trying to survive, that they've been able to get away with doing what they've done. This is a wake-up call. This is an alert. This whole conference and the one that's subsequently going to come after this is a wake-up call. It is almost too late to stop what is now a post-constitutional government. The people are no longer ruling in our country. The government, in a tyrannical form, is now ruling the people by subversion, force, and fear. Sadly, that's what we have today. The reason I am here is the question is always asked, where are the whistleblowers? If there is a covert geoengineering program, why aren't people coming out and blowing the whistle on it if it's so dangerous? The NSA surveillance program, if it wasn't for Edward Snowden, who both the Democratic and Republican Party have come out publicly and said they want him assassinated. If it wasn't for Edward Snowden, would we know about the NSA spying program? That was collecting 1.5 billion pieces of information on you and me and our telephones and our internet communications, our emails. That's what they were doing. Not on terrorists, on us. And they were storing it in the Utah data center, which is still there forever. So if there's something you do later on that they're not real happy with, they've got your emails, your text, your cell phone conversations, and everything still stored in the database. And all that stuff, by the way, is still there on you. not on terrorists. Every single American citizen. So this is what we have here. We have a government that is functioning outside the Constitution. This is the size of the secret government. I call it the shadow government. There are some people call it the deep state. Take your pick. Same thing. We've got the CIA, functions covert programs. They're probably the most out of control because their charter is so loose. The IRS has covert programs. FBI, Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security, Department of State, Department of Justice, the NSA, and I have added the National Weather Service and NOAA, because as Dane, I think, told you, the National Weather Service and NOAA are now binding their employees with secrecy agreements so they cannot talk without penalty of prison about some of these climate programs that they're doing. That's called a red flag. That's what we're facing. Here is the first whistleblower, John F. Kennedy. The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. One of the greatest speeches ever given in terms of the Constitution. And there is a very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That was a prophetic message by John F. Kennedy, April 27, 1961. We all know what happened to him in 1963, don't we? They had identified, John F. Kennedy and Robert had identified mafia connections within the CIA. There was an assassination program. They engaged in the Bay of Pigs without his knowledge. He had come out publicly and said he was going to break the CIA into 1,000 pieces and dismantle it. And then in 1963, we saw what happened. 9/11, we don't have time to go into that. I just want to say this. I teach criminal investigations at a university. 9/11 was immediately labeled a terrorist event, and there was a reason for that. When you label it a terrorist event, it stops any sort of criminal investigation right in its tracks. If they would have done a criminal investigation of 9/11, it would have uncovered things that would have painted a whole different picture about why those buildings came down. I would encourage you to, architects and engineers for truth have done an outstanding video about Tower 7. Tower 7 was not hit by a plane, and it came down under a controlled definition. Now, I'm a former CIA analyst, and I'm saying that based on a whole lot of research, that was not done by a plane. And just finally, when the towers came down, hundreds of tons of metal, steel, marble and concrete turned to dust before it hit the ground. So much so that there was almost no seismic activity when the buildings hit the ground. It was all dust. You can see steel girders as they come down, if any of you have seen that, literally vaporize and turn to dust as they fall down. That is not natural. All we're going to say there. I recommend you look into a criminal investigation of 9/11 and get past the terrorist narrative, which has been a favorite one for decades. Where are the whistleblowers? I come from the belly of the beast. I was an interviewer, interrogator. I was a counterintelligence agent. I was a polygraph examiner. I was an internal investigator, and I was on and on and on. And so I know this system, and I know it well, and then I experienced it personally. Why don't people come out in these secret programs that they know are illegal and unconstitutional? Why don't they come out and blow the whistle and tell people what's going on? Well, this is why. The U.S. government, every secret operational program that it has, forces the employee or coerces the employee, the person, into signing what is called a secrecy agreement, non-disclosure agreement. Now, back in the original days, the secrecy agreement was created to protect legitimate sources and methods, military technology and things like that. That was okay. That was fine. The secrecy agreement protected us when we went out in the field, because if they found out who we were, we wouldn't just be killed, we would have been tortured. So it protected our identities, protects the identities of troops in the field doing movements out during wartime. That's how it started. But it's been taken and it's been turned into a monster, where the secrecy agreement is now being used as the ultimate tool of intimidation. Every employee that gets a job and obtains knowledge of these covert programs, the Air Force Geoengineering Program, in my opinion, has to sign this agreement. What the agreement says is, if you disclose anything that you know about this program, you can be terminated or you can force criminal penalties. In other words, you can be put in prison. Good friend, we hope we'll be speaking at our next event, was put in prison by the CIA for 2 years that he exposed the torture program, which was a lot more than waterboarding, folks. As a matter of fact, they got almost nothing out of waterboarding. People died. It was It was bad. Anyway, he came out, publicly talked about the torture program, made one mistake, one wrong word. They convicted him, John Curacao, and they put him in prison for 2 years. Modern-day hero. Just got out. So served 2 years for coming out and trying to alert people about what was going on. I was talking to somebody in the back. I have to watch every single word I say because they are just waiting for one thing. And so it's a constant screen. You don't want to give them any ammunition to put in their gun. So there's binding power, penalties, and threats for the secrecy agreement. That stops 99% of the people right there. Oh, man, I'm not going there. I'll just look the other way. Uh-uh. I don't want to go to jail. I don't want to lose my job. I don't want my life destroyed. Now, there is a massive, mammoth, complex, secret mechanism in the U.S. government. It's called the intelligence community. It is so powerful that not even the Congress or the Senate can control it. Matter of fact, it controls them. It does whatever it wants. They have these Senate investigations, and they'll come and they say, sorry, Senator, we can't tell you what we're doing because you don't have the agency clearance. And that's where it's shut down. Benghazi is an example. The NSA surveillance program is an example. Where did those go? Nowhere. And I sit on the Citizens Commission of Benghazi, and that's a whole other story. Maybe the next conference. Anyway, began in 1948. I talk about this in the book real quickly. An Air Force B-2 bomber had four RCA civilian engineers on board. The plane went down in a horrible accident. A couple of the pilots parachuted out. All four engineers were killed in a horrible crash. The widows of the engineers demanded to know from the Air Force why the plane crashed and why their husbands died. The Air Force came back and said, well, we can't tell you that because it's secret. Turns out it was gross negligence on behalf of the pilot. Drove the plane into the ground, hit the wrong flaps, hit the thruster instead of the opposite, and literally drove that bomber right into the pharma. I've been to the site. I have pictures of it in the book. So the families pushed it and said, no, it wasn't classified. You can't do that. We're suing you for the death of our husbands. So the United States government, the executive branch, created what's called the state's secrets privilege. The state's secrets privilege was literally, the wording was derived from the monarchy of the King of England, which gave the King of England absolute power to shut down any case they deemed was unacceptable. Just shut it down. The state secrets privilege was used to shut down these four widows' case. It was shut down. It was sealed in federal court so that no one, including Congress, the Senate, and their attorneys would ever see it. And that's where this all began in 1948. And it's gotten far worse from there. People who signed this binding secrecy agreement, which I have signed several of in several compartments as well, they are not told, and they do not know that when they sign that agreement, they are giving up all of their constitutional rights. They have no right to trial. They have no right to a jury trial. They have no right to sue the government if they are exposed to toxins and made sick, or their family or anyone else. They have lost all their rights to due process. They're not told that. I found that out the hard way. When I tried to sue the government, and they came back and said, sorry, pal, you don't have any rights. So I took a different course, which I'll tell you about here in a moment. So that's how they shut them up, too. There is within each federal agency. Now, remember, since 1948, this procedure has been perfected. It is a science to destroy a whistleblower from the very beginning. They come to a supervisor. They may even have the courage to call their congressman or senator about this illegal operation, and the first thing that happens is they start getting promotions denied, even though they're top performers. Their promotions are denied. They're given embarrassing assignments where they're put in the corner of a building somewhere so that everybody knows that they're being penalized for this. If they continue to blow the whistle and push it even farther, they'll do things like this. I have seen this personally. They'll raise the interest rates on the credit union loans so that their cars and other loans are unaffordable. If they try to pull out their retirement funds to provide for their family, especially in the case where they've been driven out of the organization will block their retirement funds so the family will be destroyed financially. Now, that is a felony. For a federal agency to deny the retirement funds of an employee is a felony. I've seen them do that. And it was an interesting case. They will do that. Now, another thing that they will do, just so you all know this, and I want the public to know this too, what they'll do is they'll say, okay, we can see that you're very stressed out by all this, and we want to help you. So we're going to refer you to the Office of Medical Services so you can undergo some psychological counseling to help you sleep at night and make you better and get rid of your anxiety. So we're going to set up an appointment for you to meet with a psychologist. Now, where do you suppose that goes? The interview's over. The document is falsified. Employee is paranoid, obsessive, compulsive, and disgruntled. That goes in the file. So if it ever does get to the Congress or Senate or court, they pull out and say, well, look, he or she went under an evaluation and they're basically unstable. End of story. Shut the case down. Part of an intentional process. It is a campaign. Inspector Generals, you guys, you know that every federal agency has an IG, an Inspector General, right? They're created, supposedly, to oversee that agency and keep it out of criminal activity, right? Well, wrong. A lot of Inspector Generals, now I have to give some kudos to the state IG because they helped me expose one particular operation. My agency's IG, I submitted a 15-page complex documented report documenting my family was exposed to toxins. My wife was bleeding out of her gums. She was bruising all over her body. She lost her short-term memory. She was on morphine because of severe headaches because of the toxins. They didn't want people to know about that she was being exposed to. That's what they didn't want people to know. So I submitted this document to the IG. Look, I did secret tests. I ran samples out to certain reputable universities. I secretly flew my son out for medical evaluation with a well-known immunologist. I got it all back, put it all together, went into their desk, laid it on there and said, tell me there's no toxins on this base. So they got the IG involved. We go into the big meeting with the IG. And I said, bring out my investigation, my report. Well, we don't know where it is. Now, I've been told by other officers that the roof was being raised off headquarters because of this case. Reporters were calling from all over the place trying to get information. The headquarters was freaking out. They knew darn well what this case was. So I pressed them. I had my two courageous attorneys there, Clint Blackman and George Hardy. And I always say this, God bless you guys. I love you, man. They had courage, and I hope someday they get the credit for that. But we got the IG finally to pull out my investigative report that had all this evidence in it. What did we get? We got a one-page document written in someone else's handwriting that said that there was no problem at all and their investigation had revealed nothing. So, are IGs always objective and honest? If they have interest in that organization, I can tell you right now, no. Should be, but they're not. Because of all of this, within these federal agencies, the NSA, the CIA, the DIA, any agency that, especially the covert agencies that engage in nefarious operational programs, there is a culture of fear. You guys out there that still work there know what I'm talking about. Everyone, I used to call it the paranoia palace. Everybody inside there is afraid of saying anything because they know about this system. They will destroy you. They'll destroy your career. They'll destroy your finances. They'll destroy your family. They'll take you all the way down as far as they can, even from the outside. You remember Gary Webb, who exposed the CIA drug running operation down in Central America? Anybody know about that out there? Gary Webb eventually was driven to suicide. Remember that? Did anybody see the movie? Yeah, you see the movie. They destroyed his career, his reputation, his life, his family, and then he was found dead of a gunshot wound in a hotel room. The perfect crime. Drive him to suicide, and there's no culpability, and your problem is gone. Frank Olson jumped out of in the CIA LSD program, jumped out of the 6-story window of a hotel room, committed suicide because he had found out that the CIA was drugging people with LSD without their knowledge. What a coincidence. Frank commits suicide. John F. Kennedy again. How far will they go? Will they go that far? I think we all know the answer to that. And in a constitutional government, that's alarming, at the very least. Now, they tell us, well, 2012, the Congress and the Senate came out with, we're going to take care of this. Whistleblowers being at risk and their lives being destroyed, their careers being destroyed. So we're going to pass the 2012 Whistleblower Protection Act, allowing any whistleblower that sees any illegal activity on the part of the government, we're going to protect them so they can come out and report it. Sounds good, doesn't it? Sounds like a good thing. What they don't tell you is if you read down through the act, anybody that has signed a secrecy agreement, is involved in any covert government program or handles anything classified is not covered by the Whistleblower Protection Act. They have no protection. They are 100% at risk. And there are some that have come out thinking they were protected by this, and they were not. And they were penalized. That's the whole idea. I talked about the state secrets privilege. These cases are sealed, and no one can see them forever once they're sealed in court. And this was kind of the most disconcerting for me. There are certain major newspapers, of which if I mentioned their name, you would know them. These are national papers that are communicating and directly connected, in this case, to the CIA and, in some cases, to the NSA. So, if a whistleblower decides, I'm freedom of the press, man, you know, I'm going to the press and I'm going to report to the press this illegal stuff that I've seen. So they call up XYZ national newspaper, and if you do enough checking, you'll find out who that is. I want to tell you my story. I want to tell you what I've seen. In this case, the reporter got right on the phone, contacted the CIA, and told them what this person had just reported for the story. That has been done several times with this paper. They communicate with the CIA regularly regarding what they're going to publish and what they're not going to publish. Chilling. I call this massive structure the shadow government. Another fellow calls it the deep state. Take your pick. But I want to show you how massive this secret government is. Now, this is since 9/11. I can tell you a lot of this was pre-existing 9/11. Most people think that the NSA surveillance program was a result of 9/11. Isn't that what you've been told? The NSA surveillance program existed before 9/11 happened. That's what they're not telling you. 1,271 government organizations involved in secrecy within the United States. 1,931 private companies, large private companies, involved in secrecy in the United States, bound by the secrecy agreement. 10,000 intelligence locations across the United States. Did you get that? 10,000 secret locations, not overseas, not in China, not in Indonesia, not in the inside the United States. Now, the CIA legally is only supposed to have a foreign charter. Anybody know that? It was forbidden from having any operations within the United States. That was its restraint. That restraint is now gone. 10,000 locations. 4.8 million Americans, and that's just the ones we know of, hold government security clearances and are bound by and threatened by the secrecy agreement to stay silent. Now, the figure's a lot bigger than that, but that's a lot of people and their families and everybody that they're connected to. Do you think they're going to speak up if it means total destruction? Probably not. 854,000 people hold top secret security clearances, which has severe penalties, and there's compartments above that, some of which I had, that have even stricter penalties. But that is the number of people that have top secret security clearances where they've got the keys to the kingdom, essentially. Each one of these agencies employs the secrecy agreement as a binding tool. Now, it used to be to protect legitimate classified information. It has morphed into a threatening tool to silence dissent. Of course, the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, the Department of State, Department of Justice, Department of Defense, Department of State, and now we know that NOAA and the National Weather Service are binding their employees with secrecy agreements. Why is the weather so secret? You got to ask that, don't you? Maybe Dane's right. Why do they have to bind people like that? I am a huge proponent of the truth, and I am really, really up against secrecy in a constitutional government unless it's absolutely necessary. Why would the National Weather Service make a weather program secret and make people sign a non-disclosure form? You got to ask that question. The military-industrial complex, tens of thousands of government contractors. The government comes, for example, most people don't know this, the CIA has a technical firm it's created called InQtel. InQtel offered, I think it was a $5 million contract to Google. Now, what they do is they come to these companies and they say, hey, we'll give you a contract for $5 million, $20 million. And most companies are thirsty and they're out trying to get contracts to survive. So they'll say, oh, we'll take the contract. Google took the contract, $5 million contract. They are now joined with the CIA in Qtel. What are they doing? They're doing research on trends on the Internet and Facebook. They're monitoring the Internet is what they're doing. Let me just break that down for you. Now, do you think any of the Google executives can talk about the program? Do you think maybe they made them sign an agreement before they got the $5 million? Yeah. Why don't you hear anything about that? Why isn't Google saying anything about that? Well, that's why. Employees at every level. If you've got big-time Beltway Bandit government contractor X that gets a covert agency contract, they are bound to sign the secrecy agreement, and every employee at every level on that contract has to sign the agreement. Secretaries, logistics people, of course, the CEOs, people that run the copy machines, all bound by the secrecy agreement. Thousands and thousands of people. You see the number of people that are bound by the government out there? Are you kind of getting that picture? It's a lot. And that's just the ones that we know of.
And again, you were just listening to the first part of a speech given by CIA whistleblower Kevin Shipp. And that's Shipp, S-H-I-P-P. His recently released book is called In the Company of Shadows. Tune in next week to hear the second and final part of this highly informative speech. And since we're discussing the CIA, I want to recommend another book. This one is by Douglas Valentine, who previously wrote the book called The Phoenix Project, which is about CIA infiltration, pacification, and assassination in every corner of South Vietnam. His new book is called The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. In this book, he talks about how the Phoenix program has been adapted to the U.S. through the Department of Homeland Security and its fusion centers. It's a really important book. I highly recommend it. And again, the title is The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World by Douglas Valentine. And now I want to remind you that 9/11 Wake Up Call is archived at the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit 4, so radioforall.net. Once on the site, click on Contributors, and then find my name, Cheryl, on the third page under the letter C. Click on my name, and the show should pop up in chronological order. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. The Republicans' abysmal replacement, the American Health Care Act. Much of the talk surrounding its impact focuses on insurance numbers and premium hikes. Those things are certainly important, but this is more important. The Republican plan caused unnecessary suffering and preventable death.
We'll discuss how we know this and how our great victory at defeating Trump Care opens the opportunity for the American public to seize the time for health care for all with a single-payer system, Medicare for all.
And now we speak with Dr. Donald Moore, Physicians for a National Health Program, New York Metro Chapter, and MD, MPH, and Deborah Berger, co-president of National Nurses United and registered nurse. I want to begin with, the National Budget Office told us there were numbers about maybe 24 million people who would not be receiving health care benefits, insurance coverage under the Trump Care plan. But how do we really know?
You've underscored the most important point, that based on the new health care bill, the American Health Care Act put forward by the Republicans, it's estimated by the federal government that some 14 million people are going to not have health insurance who would have had it under the current law. So about 14 million people in 2018. And if we go a little bit further to 2020, the number goes up to 21 million and up to 24 million by the next decade. So clearly this bill, we're likely to see less insured, which means the concept of universal insurance, which we were hoping we would be achieving within the next decade or so, less likely to occur. Universal insurance, which means everybody in the country has health insurance.
I'd like to add that we know that millions left out of the Republican health care plan because even under the Affordable Care Act, there are millions of people already without insurance, and that plan was supposed to have made things better for people, which it did, but it still left people uninsured. And the proposals to transfer the responsibility of providing Medicare to the states via block grants to make it even worse, because state budgets are already strained, they aren't going to make up the gaps in health care that the federal government did under the Affordable Care Act.
Who's the ones that are left out of this?
It's the poor people in the country. I think there was a very cynical look at how they tailor health care and the restructuring, and they figured that the poorest in our community, including children, minors, generally as a block, people that don't vote are the most affected. They're concerned about retaliation in the voting booth, but they don't seem to be as concerned about people of color, very frail, elderly, and the extremely poor in this country.
Donald, about half of the people losing health care will be Medicaid recipients, and a large number also of poor people between the ages of 50 and 65. We talked a bit about Medicaid. If you want to add something to that, fine. But what about this other group from 50 to 65?
You're absolutely correct. With the American Health Care Act, we're now just shifting where the benefits went, moving away from the poor, which were the Medicaid eligible and people up to 400% of the poverty level who could get subsidies, eventually going away. Also, a very important group, which I think neither one of the health reform plans really adequately addressed, was the people who are not yet at Medicare but are high risk for chronic diseases. We're talking about people between, say, 50 years old and, say, 64 years old. 65 is when we are eligible for Medicare. But we have people who have very, very large health needs, not have access to insurance unless they're employed by a large employer such as the government or a large employer that gives health insurance. The premiums for that elderly non-Medicare group to actually go up. The Affordable Care Act limited how the insurances could be sold to the various ages. Now, it's normal for insurance companies to charge different premium rates to different groups based on their expectation of use of whatever product they're selling. So if you have a young person in their early 20s who is not likely to become ill compared to somebody in their 50s who is a lot more likely to become ill, then it's reasonable for an insurance company to charge a lower rate for the younger person and a higher rate for the older person. However, because most of us believe healthcare is a right and we should all have access to it, the insurance companies and governments do what's called community rating. They put everybody in the same pool, spread the risk across so that no one is hit with a very high rate. So with the American Healthcare Act, some unraveling of that, which was addressed to some extent under the ACA, the Affordable Care Act.
One of the other proposals, really onerous, a work requirement in the Medicaid block grant so that if you're eligible for Medicaid, that you somehow have to try to have employment, which belies the fact that a lot of the people that are on Medicaid are children, also disabled, and can't get a job in order to satisfy that requirement. So it's pretty deadly no matter how you look at it when you're looking at whether the issue of saying that you have to maintain your coverage without a gap or they can charge you three times the premium. There is so much bad with this.
And I want both of you to further punctuate the issue of race and class here. Who are the losers? To what degree can we say that there really is a disparate impact for poor people and a disparate impact for people of color, immigrants who are quote unquote legal in this society, etc.? How does Trump care affect those particular groups and that class of people?
If you're 0.1 of the 1%, extremely well under this, because this is the largest transfer of public wealth to individuals in a class that already is doing extremely well and has done well over this last decade, even during the Great Recession. What isn't really being talked about a lot, they have us looking at all of these headlines about Russia and about spying and things like that, however, impact those people that most need health care in this country. And it worries me because even our Democratic politicians in Washington aren't willing to stand up and say that this is a huge tax giveaway package. It has almost nothing to do with health care when you look at the huge tax breaks that the wealthy are going to get.
This is Donald Moore. The obvious loser is basically poor people, people who benefited when the Affordable Care Act expanded Medicaid. If you were in a state where Medicaid was expanded 138% of the poverty level, then you would definitely benefit. However, neither of these laws really address the issue of health care for the American public. As was pointed out by my colleague, the Affordable Care Act left certainly up to 30 million Americans uninsured, and another 31 million who are underinsured. Underinsured basically means that you're still not getting health care, even though you have an insurance card in your pocket, because your deductible is too high, your copayment is too high, or you know very well that the health care that I'm going to access is not going to be useful to me. So there is an attitudinal underinsurance. Just, you know, I have a lousy insurance. The doctors in my network or the hospital in my network is not really what I want. And of course, there is a structural underinsurance, which combines those two factors. So we really never did get close to universal health care. The problem is, though, that despite all of that, the American people are spending even more money on health care. Imagine when the Affordable Care Act was passed, we were sent to a website to buy insurance from basically private insurance companies. Now, here it is. This was our fund, government fund, that was being transferred to private insurance companies, with who were then giving us products that we couldn't use. Now, let me give you an example. I had insurance last year. I had what the Republicans are now promoting as a HSA, health savings account. The way that works is you put your own money aside to pay the doctor, to pay for your drugs, and then you buy a catastrophic insurance. The first year that I had this insurance, I needed health care. Between my wife and I, we spent $6,000. And we spent another $12,000 on the premium. So after I spent all that money, I now finally could use the insurance. Well, what did the insurance company do? They dropped me because I used the insurance. So I spent almost $15,000 up front for health care and then ended up with no health care because I was not dealing with a government who basically was going to guarantee my rights. I was dealing with a private profit company. So that's the kind of health care that we have. Now, I say this to point out that these solutions that we're being offered are inadequate. They don't work. Obamacare didn't work for me. Trump care will definitely not work for me, not as a doctor, not as a taxpayer, and certainly not as one consumer of health care. What really would work for me is a system where I was guaranteed to have health care from the day I was born. Whether I was working or not, I would have health insurance that would give me access to health care. And when I did make this access, whether it's through seeing a physician or going to a hospital, I would not have to take so much money out of my pocket that I would have second thoughts on whether I would want to have that care. Basically, what we're talking about is a system that's universal and a system that eliminates the commercial payers.
Deborah, why don't you follow through on that and talk about the system that both Donald's organization, the Physicians for National Health Care, and your union, the National Nurses United, wants, and that is the Medicare for All or single-payer system.
There's no reason for me to believe that we can't fight Trump care, the big giveaway to the insurance industry, and advocate and fight for single-payer system. We've helped many states that have been trying to get single-payer enacted. The last time was Colorado Care, which drew millions and millions of dollars from the healthcare industry to fight against it. But here in California, we're going down the legislative angle again. We have Senator Ricardo Lara, who is going to sponsor SB 562, and it's called the California Health and Care Act. And you can find the details on our website through calnurses.org. Essentially, it would finance the Healthy California through a number of mechanisms. One is a payroll and income tax premium, which is higher for upper income earners, so it is progressive. And it would replace the insurance premiums, copays, and deductibles most people are already paying. You would be able to choose any provider. If you wanted Kaiser to provide your care, they would still be part of that system, but there would be no out-of-pocket expenses. It would eliminate copays for Medicare Part D because we would take over administering Medicare and Medicaid to the states. We would take that money and include them also in this Affordable Care Act. It would also include vision, dental, because nurses know that you can't just say healthcare without affecting some other parts of the body that have a specific territory carved around them that need to be dealt with. We would have regional planning to avoid duplication of expensive equipment and facilities. There are a number of things that we learned from the Affordable Care Act that would be folded into the new system, like pre-existing conditions, and you wouldn't have to worry about kids over 26 being covered because they would be covered. But it would also save because of a reduced bureaucracy. We wouldn't have to worry about insurance company run around. There'd be no more bill collectors. And I'm sure the doctor would testify that when you're running a doctor's office, half of your staff that are there are used for getting their money back from the insurance companies. So it's a bill that we think has a good deal of likelihood passing. We've made it what's called a two-year bill because we think that that gives us time to educate the public on their options and also to find out exactly what's going to happen with the healthcare, quote, reform in Washington, D.C.
And Donald, New York State has a similar bill, so do you want to talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. The New York health bill is quite similar to the bill in California, and Debbie will probably tell you that that bill in California got through both houses and then was vetoed by the governor at the time, Schwarzenegger. Hopefully, we don't have that similar fate in New York. As you know, in New York, the New York Health Act passed the assembly multiple times. As a matter of fact, it's a very popular bill. It passed the assembly by a very large margin, and it's just a few more senators in New York that need to come on board. And, of course, hopefully the governor will sign it. What these state plans do is they're an intermediate step to a national health program. The Physicians for a National Health Program is an organization that's been around since the late 70s. And healthcare reform in America has been a long road. This goes back well over 100 years. We've been trying to figure out how to provide health to the population through insuring the population. So health insurance is not new. The question was asked earlier, you know, can we make sure that we don't take the step backwards and move back to the so-called Trump care from Obamacare, and at the same time move to something progressive such as a single-payer universal health plan for all Americans? And the answer is definitely yes. You know, I can also certainly walk and chew gum. More importantly, it would be inappropriate to stop at Obamacare. You know, there's what's known as sort of path dependence. The last battle is what sets up the next fight. And, you know, Obamacare was the last battle, and we ended up there because there were many battles before. As many of you will remember, the Clintons had a health plan, Senator Kennedy had a health plan, and as we go back, Truman had a health plan. As a matter of fact, they thought President Truman was trying to put socialized medicine in the American health population. But we go way back with these plans. There is nothing really new that I certainly have heard about health care or any health program. Most of what you see being implemented, whether it's the Affordable Care Act or the American Health Care Act, these are programs that have been introduced many, many years ago. It's just a matter of the political will to make sure that we move in the right direction and continue to move in the right direction. Many feel that, okay, maybe too big a step to jump to a single payer. I certainly think that it's not too big a step. But the fact is, we don't want to go backwards. We don't want to disenfranchise and certainly take away the health care from people who already have it. What we want to do is we want to move towards universal health insurance, 100% of the population being insured. Because when we're not insured, it's not only our health that's at risk. Our entire financial well-being is at risk. 62% of bankruptcies in the United States result from health expenses. People who, when they got an illness, generally a catastrophic illness, they have health care. They have some kind of health insurance. But because many of us get our health care from our employer, when you get sick, you no longer
are able to work. Once you stop working, you lose your insurance. When you lose your insurance and you can't pay for your health care, you get sick or you can't work, then what do you lose next? You lose your house, you lose your car, and then you're in debt. You go bankrupt. So that's what happened to a majority of people who got into bankruptcy. It resulted from health care. So there is financial security in health insurance. It's not just access to health care. The Affordable Care Act, this discussion we're having over and over that mobilized so many people and so many Americans against each other, only a quarter of that bill deals with access to care. The majority of the Affordable Care Act really deals with things that we're not even discussing about our healthcare delivery system. It deals with things like the training of nurses, the training of doctors, you know, access to, you know, there was a part of it that gave us access to long-term care. So there's a lot that we'll have to fix in our healthcare delivery system. But what our discussion tonight is really about is really access to healthcare through health insurance. And the only reasonable solution for Americans is really a single payer. And what is single payer versus a multi-payer? A single payer is the least expensive path. With multiple insurance companies, we have to give profits to multiple insurance companies. With multiple insurance companies, we have to set up administrative structures for each one. As a physician, if I'm dealing with 20 insurance companies, my staff needs to know 20 different rules. They need to fill out 20 different forms or have 20 different forms available. That's very costly. If there was one, it would be simple. I would know the rules. Everybody would know the rules. We would all have access to all the providers. The way it is right now, we're in different silos. If you're in my network, then you can go to my hospital and you can see my colleagues who are in the network. If you go out of network, you're going to be punished. You're going to have to either pay your own way or you're going to have to pay extra. So the system we have, this multi-payer system, is inefficient and it actually creates less access to the physician or the provider that you would like to see.
And we're almost out of time, but I want to give Deborah Berger the last opportunity in the last 2 minutes to pick up on what Dr. Donald Moore was saying and how are the nurses and we to organize to defeat Trump care and to bring to our public health care for all, a universal system, removing the insurance companies from the process, a system of Medicare for all. Deborah Berger?
What we really have to understand when we're talking to all of our fellow colleagues, our nurses, and everyone, is that in addition to all of the tax credits and things that are being used to either support this or not, there's also roughly about $4 billion of annual transfers of funds from state and federal treasuries to our insurers to provide coverage for people that are employed, because businesses do get to deduct the cost of health care as a business deduction. That is a pool of money that could also be used to fund health care. The money is there. And the nurses are busy in various states working to lobby legislators to take another look at single payer. It's no accident that both in Canada and other countries, if you look at how they supply care to the 13 high-income nations, Sweden, Switzerland, Germany, Canada, Australia, all spend far less total than we do, and they have better outcomes for infant mortality. They have the best life expectancy and quality of life, and what we need to do is actually not only talk to people that are our normal allies, but to reach people that don't normally fall into our sphere of influence. And I think that's where the nurse's strength is, because we're used to talking with people that normally aren't in our social group to get them to understand what's at stake. And we do have a lot of literature that we're going to be producing. So if you go to National Nurses United, you'll see information there, as well as the California Nurses Association, on not only SB 562, but trying to get through the legislature nationally to get the information out there. We're doing another People's Summit in June, where healthcare will be one of the issues that's being discussed. We plan on making sure that we educate everyone on where the money is and how much our priorities need to change in order to accomplish single payer.
Deborah Berger, co-president of National Nurses United and registered nurse. Dr. Donald Moore, past president of the Medical Society of the County of Kings, Physicians for a National Healthcare Program, New York Metro Chapter, and MD, MPH. Thanks for the introduction to this discussion that Ken and I are going to be following through on consistently until we have a universal healthcare system. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
What about LGBTQ individuals?
What about them? They're people. Equal justice under law.
Does that refer to sexual orientation as well?
Trump is peppering his cabinet, his Supreme Court appointments with people who want to assert that there is a religious law that supersedes civil law. And that is, to me, the
real
threat.
That's the end of America.
To This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Taiwan's top court tackles marriage equality, Queensland dethrones the gay panic defense, and U.S. Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch glides around confirmation questions. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending March 25, 2017. Taiwan's highest court held historic hearings this week on whether or not the island's civil code unconstitutionally defines civil marriage as only between one man and one woman. Authorities in the pro-queer capital city of Taipei have joined a gay couple in the lawsuit that began in 2013 when activist Chi Chia Wei's attempt to register their marriage was rejected. Taipei's government says it needs national clarity from the Council of Grand Justices on the recognition of same-gender couples. Taiwan's legislature approved the first draft of a bill to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples in December. But a second reading isn't scheduled anytime soon. The possible advance toward marriage equality has fueled a backlash by conservative religious groups on the island. There have been heated pro and con demonstrations for a number of months. A decision by the Council of Grand Justices is expected to be announced within 2 months. A ruling that the heterosexuals-only marriage laws are unconstitutional would take the political heat off lawmakers by essentially forcing them to enact a marriage equality law. That would make Taiwan the first in Asia to open civil marriage to same-gender couples.
The wheels continue to torturously turn in Australia over civil marriage equality. Several prominent executives from the nation's business community recently signed a joint letter to Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull calling for a free vote in Parliament on the issue. The 20 co-signers included openly gay Qantas Airlines CEO Alan Joyce. But the Turnbull government is standing firm in opposition to a free vote. Immigration Minister Peter Dutton, who personally opposes equality, has now proposed instead a national mail-in vote on the issue. The government's effort to pass a bill to hold a required in-person national vote failed in Parliament late last year, and critics have assailed the postal proposal as even more preposterous. Every public opinion poll shows overwhelming support in Australia for opening civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. But Liberal Party PM Turnbull promised his farther-right National Party coalition partner that his government would only allow marriage equality to be enacted by a popular vote and that he would never allow government MPs to vote their conscience on the issue. Turnbull could lose his job if he breaks that promise.
But Queensland lawmakers this week passed legislation to repeal the section of the Australian state's criminal code that lowers the sentence for crimes committed in the heat of passion caused by sudden provocation from a homosexual advance. Such statutes are commonly known as a gay panic defense. Activists have been campaigning for removal of the provision in Queensland since the brutal gay bashing murder of Wayne Rux in 2008. His killers were convicted of manslaughter instead of murder after they used the gay panic defense to claim that they reacted so violently because Rux had grabbed one of the men's crotches. One of his attackers was released after serving just 4 years of a 9-year manslaughter sentence. Queensland Attorney General Yvette Diaz said that eliminating the gay panic defense sends an important message that discrimination is not acceptable and that we value the LGBTI community. South Australia is now the only state in the country to allow a gay panic defense.
In U.S. news, 38-year-old Alphonza Watson was murdered this week in Baltimore, Maryland. She became the eighth trans woman reported murdered in the country this year. Witnesses told police that they heard someone yelling for help. Then they heard gunshots and saw two men getting into a dark-colored vehicle and speed away. A police spokesperson told the Baltimore Sun that they don't have a lot to go on. Her mother, Peggy Walker, called Alphonza the sunshine of our family. She was a very caring, passionate, fun person to be around, Walker said, always in a talkative and playful mood. She said Alphonza, who went by the nickname Peaches, worked at an upscale retailer in Virginia, where she was one of its best salespeople. Last year was the deadliest on record for trans people in the U.S., with 27 known homicides. Most victims, and all eight so far this year, were women of color. The real number is probably much higher because police or media may have misgendered some victims or their deaths were not reported at all.
Trump's Secretary of Energy, Rick Perry, took time away from his busy schedule regulating the U.S. nuclear industry this week to complain about the groundbreaking election of openly gay Bobby Brooks, an economics junior at the flagship campus of Texas A&M University in College Station, as student body president. Brooks became the first out candidate to win that post. He promised his 60,000 constituents to improve student services and increase diversity and inclusion campus-wide. A student judicial court gave the victory to Brooks as the runner-up candidate after the leading vote-getter was disqualified for failing to report a campaign expense. Perry, an A&M graduate, charged in an op-ed in the Houston Chronicle that a diversity agenda tainted the election. A spokeswoman for A&M told reporters that all the student body election rules were followed and that Perry's characterization doesn't reflect the facts. Mark Jones, a Rice University political science professor who's followed Perry's career since before he became governor of Texas, told the Chronicle that it was certainly not something you expect a cabinet secretary to weigh in on, or even a governor, and that it was probably not the smartest move.
The Osage Nation has become the latest Native American tribe to open marriage to same-gender couples. Tribes are treated as sovereign nations by the U.S. government, so the June 2015 Supreme Court marriage equality ruling doesn't apply to couples on Native lands. The Osage Nation claims some 20,000 members, mostly in the state of Oklahoma. The move to open marriage to gay and lesbian couples was approved by a 53% vote in a first-ever referendum on amending tribal law. There are more than 550 Native American tribes in the U.S., and only a handful have specifically enacted marriage equality, including the Cherokee Nation and the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes. Some other tribes have simply decided that they'll follow the laws of the states in which they're located.
Elsewhere, Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin signed a bill this week that will allow student groups at public high schools and universities to discriminate against potential LGBT members based on religious grounds. It passed in both houses of the legislature with broad bipartisan support and is part of a growing movement across the country to enact laws that allow religious belief to trump civil rights. A similar law is already on the books in Kansas.
But Virginia's Democratic governor, Terry McAuliffe, vetoed two bills passed by the Republican-dominated state legislature that would have allowed taxpayer-funded agencies and service providers to discriminate against same-gender couples based on religious or moral objections. Mississippi approved a similar measure last year, but a federal judge put it on hold after ruling that the law was unconstitutional. The case is under review at the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals.
A Tennessee Senate committee rejected an obviously anti-trans North Carolina-like measure this week that would have required people to use sex-segregated public facilities based on the gender listed on their birth certificate.
And the Republican-controlled Oklahoma Senate also voted against a bill like North Carolina's HB 2 that would have prohibited cities and towns from enacting ordinances that protect LGBT people from discrimination.
In other news, the controversial Disney live-action movie Beauty and the Beast has broken box office records for the biggest opening of a film in the month of March, taking in more than $350 million worldwide so far. The so-called controversy centers on the possible gayness of LeFou, the film villain's sidekick. LeFou, who's played by Josh Gad, briefly dances with another man during a raucous bar scene, and the film's out director, Bill Condon, has described LeFou's crush on his boss as subtly gay. Russia slapped an adults-only rating on the movie because of its gay propaganda. But when Disney threatened to pull the film from Muslim-majority Malaysia after censors planned to delete the supposedly gay scene, officials relented and an uncensored Beauty and the Beast is now wowing audiences across the country. However, the film was pulled this week from theaters in predominantly Muslim Kuwait because of its so-called gay content.
And finally, another less subtle queer character debuted on movie screens this week. One of the five main characters in the reboot of the 90s TV show and film series, Power Rangers, struggles with her relationship with another girl. Director Dean Israelite says that Trini, the Yellow Ranger, eventually comes to terms with her sexual orientation and is accepted by all the other characters. David Yost, who played the Blue Ranger in the 1990s and left the series after facing harassment over his sexuality, applauded the development, saying that, "I think so many people in the LGBTQI community are going to be excited to see that representation." But apparently not LGBTQI people under the age of 18 in Russia. Like Beauty and the Beast, the Putin regime has also made Power Rangers adults-only viewing because of its gay propaganda.
That's News Wrap for the week ending March 25th, 2017, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
It began with hope, it epitomized change, and it ended with an unprecedented challenge. This Way Out follows Obama's rainbow reign, from the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, to the Supreme Court marriage equality victory, to his anti-discrimination executive orders, and his call for renewed commitment in the future, all in a new collection of historic feature reports available now on CD.
We coach Little League in the blue states. And yes, we've got some gay friends in the red states.
I am a fierce advocate for equality for gay and lesbian Americans.
We are not a nation that says, don't ask, don't tell. We are a nation that says, out of many, we are one.
I think same-sex couples should be able to get married.
Welcome to the White House. This is the 8th Pride reception that we will celebrate together.
I don't think it is something that will be reversible.
Obama's Rainbow Reign. Get this special CD production, available only at thiswayout.org.
Trump administration U.S. Supreme Court nominee Judge Neil Gorsuch showed off plenty of fancy legal footwork at his confirmation hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee the week of March 20th. However, the man chosen to replace the ultra-conservative Justice Antonin Scalia refused to tip his hand on matters of concern to women, workers, racial and religious minorities, LGBTQ people, and other groups seeking protection from the courts. National queer organizations, including GLAAD, Lambda Legal, and the Human Rights Campaign, have joined the list of civil rights advocates opposing Gorsuch's confirmation. Democrats on the Judiciary Committee pressed him hard to reveal his judicial philosophy, but most of his answers seemed designed to placate rather than illuminate. This exchange with Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois is but one example.
Let me ask you this specific one. It was 1993, and you were at Oxford, and this is when you believe you first met this professor. Professor Finnis was tapped by the then Colorado Solicitor General, Timothy Timkovich, to help defend a 1992 state constitutional amendment that broadly restricted the state from protecting gay, lesbian, and bisexual people from discrimination. During the course of the deposition which he gave in support of that effort, Fennis argued that antipathy toward LGBT people, specifically toward gay sex, was rooted not just in religious tradition, but Western law and society at large. He referred to homosexuality as bestiality in the course of this as well. Were you aware of that?
Senator, I know he testified in the Romer case. I can't say sitting here I recall the specifics of his testimony or that he gave a deposition.
I guess the reason I'm raising this is a man who apparently had an impact on your life, certainly your academic life, and I'm trying to figure out where we can parse his views from your views, what impact he had on you as a student, what impact he has on you today with his views.
Well, and I guess, Senator, I think the best evidence is what I've written. I've written over, written or joined over 6 million words as a federal appellate judge. I've written a couple of books. I've been a lawyer and a judge for 25 or 30 years. That's my record. And I guess I'd ask you respectfully to look at my credentials and my record. And some of the examples I've given you are from my record about the capital habeas work, about access to justice. I've spoken about overcriminalization publicly. Those are things I've done, Senator.
And what about LGBTQ individuals?
Well, Senator, there are. What about them?
Well, the point I made is
they're people.
Oh, and of course. But what you said earlier was that you have a record of speaking out, standing up for those minorities who you believe are not being treated fairly. Can you point to statements or cases you've ruled on relative to that class?
Senator, I've tried to treat each case and each person as a person, not of this kind of person, not of that kind of person, a person. Equal justice under law. It is a radical promise in the history of mankind.
Does that refer to sexual orientation as well?
Senator, the Supreme Court of the United States has held that single-sex marriage is protected by the Constitution.
The concerns raised by Senator Durbin were picked up later in the confirmation hearings by Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, who tried to get answers by asking Gorsuch about the mentor whose shoes he would be filling.
You are a self-professed originalist in your approach to constitutional interpretation. For example, you wrote, and I quote, "Judges should instead strive, if humanly and so imperfectly, to imply the law as it is, focusing backward, not forward, and looking to text, structure, and history to decide what a reasonable reader at the time of the events in question would have understood the law to be." Now, do you agree with Justice Scalia's statements that originalism means there is no protection for women or gays and lesbians under the Equal Protection Law because this was not the intent or understanding of those who drafted the 14th Amendment in 1868?
Senator, first of all, a good judge starts with precedent and doesn't reinvent the wheel. So the extent there are decisions on those topics, and there are, a good judge respects precedent. That's the first point. Second point I'd make is it would be a mistake to suggest that originalism turns on the secret intentions of the drafters of the language, of the law. The point of originalism, textualism, whatever label you want to put on it, what a good judge always strives to do, and I think we all do, is try to understand what the words on the page mean. Not import words that come from us, but apply what you, the people's representatives, the lawmakers, have done. And so when it comes to equal protection of the laws, for example, it matters not a whit that some of the drafters of the 14th Amendment were racists, because they were, or sexists, because they were. The law they drafted promises equal protection of the laws to all persons. That's what they wrote. And those the original meaning of those words, John Marshall Harlan captured them in his dissent in Plessy. And equal protection of the laws does not mean separate and advancing one particular race or gender. It means equal. As I said yesterday, I think that guarantee, equal protection of the laws guarantee, the 14th Amendment, that it took a civil war for this country to win, is maybe the most radical guarantee in all of the Constitution and in maybe in all of human history. It's a fantastic thing. And that's why it's chiseled in Vermont marble above the entrance to the Supreme Court of the United States.
Although the judge told Senator Feinstein that equality is equality, Senator Al Franken of Minnesota wondered if Gorsuch's support for the onslaught of state-level anti-marriage equality laws in 2004 told a different story.
How have your views of marriage equality changed, if at all, since the 2004 election?
Senator, my personal views. If I were to begin speaking about my personal views on this subject, which every American has views on, would send a misleading signal to the American people that my
personal... It's settled law.
It is absolutely settled law. There's ongoing litigation about its impact and its application right now. And I cannot begin to share my personal views without suggesting mistakenly...
Okay,
people.
Can I move on to something else?
Well,
then? Thank you. I understand. You've given a version of this answer before, so I understand. I understand.
Gosh, golly.
Smiling faces, sometimes they don't tell the truth. Smiling faces tell lies, and I got proof.
There's an all-important point left out of Judge Gorsuch's gosh and golly-filled testimony to the Senate Judiciary Committee. The ongoing litigation he referred to seeks exemptions to marriage equality laws based on so-called religious liberty. Andy Hum and Ann Northrup worried about that during this week's edition of Gay USA.
I watched as much as I could a stomach of the Neil Gorsuch hearings. He's not saying anything.
Yeah.
But he is saying some things about who has influenced him in life. And gosh, golly, he says all the time. of course, we all knew his role model was Scalia, who was the biggest anti-gay bigot on the court in the last 50 years.
I don't think he had any real role models.
He said his mentor was Justice Byron White, who also was from Colorado, as he was.
Nonsense. Well,
and he clerked for White.
Yeah.
Byron White wrote the Hardwick decision saying it was okay to ban sodomy in the United States.
I think Neil Gorsuch has much too big an ego to really have mentors or heroes.
Well, he hung out with Scalia. We saw them hunting together.
Friends, certainly.
He called Paul Clement, who argued against same-sex marriage over the last couple of years in the federal courts, a dear friend. And he was a protege of this guy named John Finnis, who was a renowned Catholic scholar, who compared same-sex relations to bestiality and described abortion as the approved killing of vulnerable, innocent human beings. So this is who he is.
Well, Gorsuch at Oxford in 2004 wrote a dissertation saying there was no right to same-sex marriage.
Right.
And this, by the way, is after it had been legalized in Massachusetts.
A former student reported that, who took his class, said that he said that many women manipulate their employers for maternity benefits and that law firms should ask female interviewees about their pregnancy plans in order to protect their companies.
Don't just believe us. Lambda Legal Defense calls him more recklessly conservative than Scalia. The National Center for Lesbian Rights refers to his dangerously radical view of religious liberty. And he, of course, is the one who said that activists like those
pushing for gay marriage rely too much on the courts and should be taking their case to the legislature or the people.
41 Democrats could filibuster him, but the Republicans have said that they will end the filibuster rule on Supreme Court nominations, as they were ended by the Democrats on federal judgeships and cabinet appointments.
So I found it very hard to watch him because I found him so smarmy, so oily, so condescending, pretentious. I thought he was completely untrustworthy in everything he said. But he wasn't like someone who just sits there and says, I'm sorry, I can't talk about that. You know, I'm going to be a judge. I just can't talk about it. He's like a guy who's still trying to prove he's the smartest guy in the room. And like, he can manipulate the process. And it wasn't an honest exchange. And he was asked about a couple of LGBT issues and will you treat LGBT people equally? Oh, yes.
No, I treat everybody the same. That's all he would say. He couldn't really talk about gay people.
No, but he said, I treat everybody the same.
Every person who comes to the court. But you're not going to have your marriage rights anymore. They alluded to the fact that the courts are considering ways of not recognizing marital benefits for gay couples. And I can't comment on that because I'm going to end those.
Well, he's also the person who wrote on his court level the Hobby Lobby decision.
Yes.
And that's all about extending these religious freedoms to allow people to discriminate. And that is the core of what we should be looking at. And Trump is peppering his cabinet, his Supreme Court appointments, whatever, with people like Gorsuch and Jeff Sessions and Ben Carson and all these people who want to assert that there is a religious law that supersedes civil law. And that is where he is trying to take this whole government. And that's a Bannon thing, too, is that religious law should supersede civil law. And that is, to me,
the real threat. That's the end of America.
Northrop and Andy Hum of Gay USA commented on the Supreme Court confirmation hearings for Judge Neil Gorsuch. You can find their show at gayusatv.org.
Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
Have you checked our website lately?
For now playing information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show,
log on to
thiswayout.org.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Francis O'Brien and Wenzel Jones contributed program material, with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. Special thanks this week to Ann Northrup and Andy Hum and Gay USA TV. David Bowie, The Undisputed Truth, and Kate Smith performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. It's always a good time to log on to thiswayout.org and join the family. And be sure to check out our new video promo for Obama's Rainbow Rain. Look for This Way Out on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KRCC Colorado Springs, Colorado, to YOU Tamworth, New South Wales, WZKW Kingsville, Ohio, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned!
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Psychiatric disorders in children seem to be skyrocketing. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimate that 1 in 54 boys and 1 in 252 girls have autism spectrum disorder. Over the past 10 years, the number of cases of bipolar disorder have increased 40-fold, and it's estimated that 1 in 10 children have ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. But what is missing from these numbers, and the attention paid to them in the popular media, is something remarkable. Large numbers of children no longer have what are supposed to be lifelong disorders by adulthood. 3/4 of kids with ADHD no longer have the condition by their mid-20s. The same is true of 1/3 of teenagers diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And 1 in 5 toddlers diagnosed with autism no longer meet the diagnosis several years later. So what's going on? Are these disorders somehow waning? Or are children being misdiagnosed with these disorders at an alarming rate? Enrico Nalotti takes the latter position in his book, Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. That's published by Beacon. Nalotti is a clinical psychologist specializing in childhood and adolescent therapy and assessment, and he joins me today. Enrico, let's start with autism. I know you're not suggesting that autism spectrum disorder isn't a real disorder. Why don't you think actual autism is on the increase?
The statistics show that there's been an almost 80% increase in over the past decade. And now the rates are like 1 in 88 children supposedly are on the spectrum, like 1 in 54 boys. So boys are diagnosed about 5 times the rate of girls, and I can hopefully at some point talk about, sort of the abnormalizing of boys, and that I see as one of the trends that is making diagnoses, autistic diagnoses, spike. But I would say no, that there's that it's a very kind of complicated phenomenon to really understand why these numbers are spiking. I think that it's partly there's the well-intentioned practice of wanting to engage in early screenings for autism spectrum disorder. It's a public health imperative. But unfortunately, the younger an age we assess for autistic spectrum disorder, the greater the risk that a struggling or slow-to-mature toddler, especially boy, will be erroneously assigned a diagnosis, at least those that inhabit the mild end on the spectrum. I think toddlerhood is probably the period of greatest diagnostic uncertainty, and most of the new cases are involve toddlers.
So what are the behaviors that therapists look for in toddlers, in young children, to diagnose autism?
Well, first, you should know that diagnosing true autism is not that difficult, in my estimation. So whenever we're talking about a clear-cut case of autism, there may not be language development, or there may be minimal language development. There may be that the subjective sense that a child is unreachable emotionally, that they're in their own world. They may have a blank stare on their face. They're sort of like they're relatively non-responsive or frequently non-responsive. They don't necessarily laugh when you laugh. They don't feed off others' emotions. So that would be a big sort of subjective criterion. They may be fascinated by they may engage in a lot of seemingly unusual repetitious behaviors, spinning around in seats, staring at spinning fans. They may have tantrums that are prolonged, where they appear inconsolable if there's sort of small changes in routines. So I think on the extreme end, true autism, and I'm someone who really wants to reserve that diagnosis for kids that really are truly autistic for a variety of reasons that we can get into. But so in that regard, it's not particularly difficult to diagnose true autism. Where it becomes complicated is on the milder end, where most of the new, which applies to most of the new cases. So now we call it autism spectrum disorder, and we see it as a on a continuum from mild to severe, and it's on the mild end that it becomes, I would say, very kind of problematic to tease apart what is a true case of mild autism versus a child who's slow to mature or struggling in a variety of ways. And many mental health professionals are not trained to really distinguish between kind of the outer edges of normal, especially in toddlerhood, when it comes to, you know, tantruming, picky eating, social and emotional skills and whatnot.
Right. Sounds like toddler behavior. But what is the danger of diagnosing children with autism being on the autistic spectrum if they don't, in fact, have autism? Isn't there a danger in not acting on the suspicion that a child might be autistic? Aren't there some therapies that could mitigate the developing disorder if it's caught early enough in childhood?
I mean, that's a very good question. Here's the rub, that oftentimes a struggling toddler who may be slow to acquire language, who may tantrum out of the norm, who may have, gross and fine motor difficulties, and that, you know, and so there's challenges there, but they're really not autistic, oftentimes can benefit from the same services that are given to mildly autistic children. So it becomes this strange phenomenon where I think many parents get caught in the trap where they want the services, and so they reluctantly will embrace the diagnosis in order to get the services. I don't think that parents should be put in that quandary. I think that we should have a more liberal access to services that struggling children can get without having a diagnosis. So in other words, you shouldn't have to have a severe diagnosis in order to get certain speech and language services, in order to get occupational therapy, in order, you know, get social skills play therapy. I think those services should be kind of widely available without, because once you go down the track where the diagnosis is assigned, other dominoes can start to fall. A diagnosis can follow a child into the school system. Some educators and some school personnel will fetishize that diagnosis. It will shape their image of what that child is capable of. They may be categorized differently, perceived differently. And as long as the diagnosis follows that child, there can be other unanticipated negatives. So, you know, as that child gets older, there are a range of, especially in the world of social media, where employers do background checks, where, you know, we want to assume that medical records are safeguarded. You know, every month there's a new story that comes out in the newspaper about leakages of big data systems, that we can't assume that medical information will remain confidential. That information can get out. It can hurt a child's as they emerge into adulthood. It can affect their employment opportunities. There are lots of jobs, believe it or not, that you cannot get with certain diagnoses. In order to get an airline, you know, to become a pilot, certain, you know, positions in the military, law enforcement, high security jobs around the country, there are, you know, screened for mental illness. And so we want to assume as a society that we're much more liberal about mental illness, and we certainly talk about these diagnoses in very folksy ways, ADHD, bipolar disorder, autism. But when you really dig into the research, we as a society, the stigma of mental illness is every bit as strong as it was a generation ago. So we have to be careful assigning a serious autism is not a frivolous diagnosis. Neither is ADHD. And neither is bipolar disorder, which are the three most common diagnoses assigned to children these days. And I think we've just become far too casual in assigning what many veteran clinicians like myself have always believed are severe, lifelong, debilitating mental illnesses. And so we shouldn't assign these kinds of diagnoses casually just to get services.
That's the voice of Dr. Enrico Nalotti. He's a clinical psychologist and the author of Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. Well, let's turn to one disorder that's diagnosed at even higher rates than autism, and that is ADHD, or Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. One in 10 children are thought to have ADHD, which is a phenomenally large number. Perhaps you could just start by saying what the characteristics are that a child needs to have to merit that diagnosis.
Well, there's two different types. There's three different types. There's the ADHD, predominantly hyperactive type, and then there's the ADHD predominantly inattentive type, and then there's the combined type. So, you know, it's possible to have ADHD and not be sort of impulsive, hyperactive, you know, overtalk, have problems waiting your turn, and this sort of thing. You can be forgetful, distractible, disorganized, have trouble kind of planning and following through. and still get the diagnosis. So, long story short, you're talking about kind of a grouping of symptoms that has to do with kids who are, to a fairly dysfunctional degree, impulsive, distractible, forgetful, disorganized, restless, and fidgety. Now, the trouble is that also parallels aspects of childhood itself, right? So all children to varying degrees are, you know, impulsive, distractible, forgetful, disorganized, fidgety. And what gets considered ADHD or not is often based on the adults in a child's life subjective comfort level with an effectiveness in handling these kinds of tendencies. So, and frankly, over the years, and I do a lot of assessing of ADHD, and I in some regards, I'm a traditionalist, even though, you know, I write critically of the diagnosis, but I still assess it in fairly conservative ways, and I distribute questionnaires. And I am really, really intrigued by the fact, and have been for decades, that I will distribute ADHD-type questionnaires to a variety of individuals, adults in a child's life, and I would say that probably only 25% of the time will I get sort of common profiles that converge on ADHD. So in other words, maybe I'll distribute it to two teachers, each of whom have radically different perceptions of a child, two parents, radically different perceptions of the same child. So it's very interesting to me that we underestimate just the subjective, and there really is no objective measure of ADHD. In other words, you can't peer into a child's brain, and that technology doesn't exist and might not ever exist. So we really rely on adults' subjective reports, in addition to other things, you know, a test of attention and concentration and whatnot. But to get the diagnosis, you have to be symptomatic in two different environments. So home and school, or home and church, or, you know, so it can't be that you're a child is symptomatic just in one environment. So actually, studies line up with my own experience over the years that if you distribute questionnaires to adults that interact with children across environments, instead of just having a parent fill out a questionnaire and a parent alone or two parents alone, the incidences of ADHD drop by 40%. So, frankly, when it's being assessed, it should be, in order to get the diagnosis, you have to be symptomatic across two environments. Every evaluator should always have multiple adults in a child's life complete questionnaires so that it can actually be accurately diagnosed. But that is actually the exception rather than the rule currently, and one of the reasons why the diagnosis is you know, overutilized.
So what are the consequences then for a child of having this diagnosis? You mentioned earlier with autism that there can be a whole range of things that can follow that child even into adulthood in terms of the stigma. But with ADHD, what about medical interventions into childhood behavior at an early age?
Well, there you go. I mean, with autism, there's really no tailored medication. You may medicate certain symptoms if a child happens to tantrum a lot or whatnot. But the diagnosis of ADHD is almost a given then that child will be it will be recommended that medication be looked at. So a diagnosis of ADHD, as distinguished from autism, medication now becomes a primary consideration. And, you know, now you get into the whole topic of the pros and cons of medicating children where there's a questionable diagnosis.
And what are the consequences for the growing body of taking these drugs, especially if they are in fact, unnecessary. Are there studies about the impact on children?
That to me is a very, very complicated question. And we, you know, depending on the age of the child, I mean, there are those that would say on like that, that we should be putting, you know, Ritalin in the water, so to speak, like fluoride for, you know, cavities. If there's a new generation of children that we're raising with like new media that have short attention spans that kind of, disadvantage them and, you know, chalk and talk classroom environments, why not? Should we just liberally prescribe it for performance reasons, you know, as a medicinal corrective for a nasty cultural trend? So there are those that would argue that. And so, you know, where's the harm, especially, you know, with the psychostimulants that have been researched for decades? And, you know, there are millions of children on them. There are risks and benefits. I can get into those if you want, but all the way to the other extreme where, you know, there are those that say we really don't know what long-term psychostimulant use, what the effects are on the brain. We actually, the research that I'm familiar with pretty much concludes, and actually this is some of the best research that's out there, that psychostimulants are scientifically supportable for up to about 2 years. The research shows that for about 2 years there are benefits for the majority of kids that have ADHD, but beyond 2 years that's not the case. In fact, if you look at the research, upwards of 80% of children that are diagnosed with ADHD and put on medication by the time they're in their early 20s no longer take meds. And upwards of 75% of kids diagnosed with ADHD as children no longer meet the criteria for the disorder, you know, by the time they hit their mid-20s.
But is that because they're growing out of the disorder, or is that because they were misdiagnosed in the first place?
My position would be that large percentages of them were misdiagnosed in the first place, and I can present some of my ideas on kind of, you know, the confines between what I call normal childhood narcissism and ADHD, and we don't really fully appreciate what constitutes normal narcissism in children and how it can look on the surface like ADHD type phenomena, and I can talk about that in a little minute here. But I think it's massively overdiagnosed, as best as I can understand that, rooted in my knowledge of the literature, is that the ADHD brain is probably an immature brain, and there's actually been an NIMH brain scan study that's discovered that 75% of ADHD children grow it in their mid-20s, and that study concludes that what we assume as ADHD is really an immature brain. It's about 3 years behind in its maturation, and that what most kids that present as ADHD in childhood are really slow to mature and their neurological and their social and emotional development, and they just need time.
So in other words, there's an unrealistic metric that's being applied to them about where they are in their development. And I guess is then the issue, and not just with ADHD, but also with autism spectrum disorder, even bipolar disorder, are some of these things that we could say are really societal issues that have a disproportionate impact on children who might be maturing at a different rate, still within normal, but, you know, not the average? Is it, in a sense, easier to point the finger at the child than the society? I'm thinking about parental expectations and then schooling, the expectation that, especially for little kids and even older kids, that they're going to have to sit still easily for long periods of time. Is there a sort of cultural societal mismatch with children in general that particularly affects those who might be slow to mature?
Absolutely. I mean, and we, you know, if you look at kind of cultural trends just in terms of children's play experiences over the decades and their access to sort of safe places to play, I would say over the past 30, 40 years, children's play has gone from being more outdoors, more animated and kinetic, and more social, to indoors, sedentary, and isolative. So it's very hard to kind of maybe look for kind of causal relationships that, you know, has that contributed to the spike in ADHD children, you know, the lack of availability or reduced availability to active play experiences where kids can run around, jump around, climb, exhaust themselves in the act of play. I would say that that is a relevant consideration. There's even research that shows that in school districts where children are given more opportunities for free play, that they're afterwards, after recess, they're more capable of sitting calmly, less fidgety, and more attentively. So there are things like that. There's a great book called The ADHD Explosion by Stephen Henshaw, is one of the main authors. And in that book, they make the argument that you can look at, after the No Child Left Behind Federal Act, Education Act that was passed a number of years ago, you can trace increases in ADHD diagnoses literally by the rate of implementation of it across the states. So the states that have the highest rates of ADHD happen to be the ones that, going back a decade or so, were the ones that first put the No Child Left Behind Act into practice. So some of your southern states, Virginia, North Carolina, have much higher rates of ADHD than, let's say, Nevada, California, Washington State, Oregon. Western states tend to have lower rates of ADHD. And in the ADHD Explosion book, they make the argument that that's just as an artifact of certain educational practices and certain perhaps unrealistic educational expectations that are placed on children that then make them symptomatic. And I would say that's especially boys.
Yes, well, I wanted to ask you about boys. Clearly, when you're looking at autism spectrum disorder or ADHD, boys are particularly likely to be diagnosed with these at much higher rates than girls. Why do you think that is?
That's a topic that's sort of near and dear, actually, to me. I mean, once again, I think I mentioned earlier, one in 54 boys are now diagnosed as autism spectrum disorder, about five times the rate of girls. Boys are given an ADHD diagnosis about three times the rate of girls. But partly, if we look, I think that there's a sort of now I'm going to say some things that might be controversial to your audience, but I think we're at a place in our culture where there's a sort of a phobia around talking about gender. But if you're the parent of a boy, if you spent any time around boys in a variety of settings, educationally, clinically, whatever, it meets the eye fairly readily. Some general gender-based differences meet the eye fairly readily. So it's not like boys, if you look at boys, the average boy's communication style, they're more likely to be logical, analytical, transactional, long-winded monologues about their favorite topics, may avoid eye contact, they may be brusque and blunt. they may be more likely to engage in what's called shoulder-to-shoulder intimacy than face-to-face intimacy. In other words, a verbal process will kick in while they're pursuing an activity together. Even if it's playing video games, then, you know, like they, many mothers wish that they could take their sons to lunch and sit across the table and have a wonderful conversation and then repeatedly get disappointed, desiring face-to-face intimacy when what may come natural to that boy is something that's more shoulder-to-shoulder intimacy, as in going for a bike ride together, or you know, picking weeds together, or you know, some activity that then that helps lubricate the interaction. So you've got that going on. The average boy's play during toddler years is autistic-like. The average boy prefers playing alone and manipulating toys in a rote fashion than using them to play make-believe. Actually, if you look at the theory of mind, which is considered one of the hallmarks of autism, that is a child's ability to sort of like put themselves in someone else's shoes, put themselves in the mind of others. Like, I have a lot of puppets in my office. You know, I ask what the puppets sort of thinking or feeling, and so that the theory of mind, being able to sort of project one's, you know, extrapolate from the outside about like what an object or a person may be sort of thinking or feeling. The average 3 to 4 year old girl is about twice as capable of theory of mind than the average boy. So just as a function of gender, so that's another reason why it gets overdiagnosed in boys. Plus with toddlerhood too, there are a range of behaviors that are typical of toddlers that can get misconstrued as autistic-like. About 1 in 5 toddlers are late talkers. About 50% of toddlers are picky eaters. About a third of parents of toddlers find their tantrums disturbing or disquieting. So, you know, and toddlerhood is a time of stubbornness, willfulness, insisting on having control over what happens to their bodies or events around them. Stubbornness that can at times get misconstrued as an autistic-like fixation on things staying the same, and you know, problems transitioning, being overly wedded to a routine. These sorts of phenomena are considered autistic-like, but they're also very developmentally appropriate for toddlers. Toddlerhood is also a period where a repetition of stimulating activities is necessary to build mastery. So stacking blocks over and over in a seemingly self-absorbed, immersed way, lining up trains in the same way over and over to obtain an experience of kinetic effectiveness and mastery, that's very consistent with toddlerhood, especially among boys. And, you know, to the unsophisticated eye, that can appear autistic-like. And then the procedures and assessment conditions geared towards when autism is being assessed can often put a vulnerable or struggling toddler over the edge, making them seem autistic-like in their ways of coping. And this is the one – I don't think that we address that issue enough in terms of the overdiagnosis problem. So even with little, like, two-year-olds, their traditional way that they're assessed for autism is that they're separated from a parent or their caregiver fairly early on in the interview. And then there's a very formal way of assessing it that for most toddlers who are attachment sensitive, that need to be put at ease in order to bring the best out in them developmentally, if they're the unintended formality of the assessment procedure itself can leave that toddler ill at ease. And then there are more primal ways of coping, you know, not engaging in eye contact, crawling under a table, whining, becoming non-communicative. These are fairly primal coping mechanisms of toddlers, they can make them look autistic-like. So it's another, especially with boys too, who may be less social to begin with. So these are some of the reasons, I think, where boys get kind of, there's a you know, and we're not talking about sort of malicious acts on the part of, you know, mental health professionals, and we're talking about perhaps just a need to address the question of gender and how boys develop differently from girls and how boys at times cope differently from girls and so on and so forth. Those more developmental topics and common sense topics, I think, need to be factored into the assessment procedure.
Sure, and those questions of gender are obviously very complicated, how it comes to be that boys turn out one way and girls turn out another. And although they're not being diagnosed with autism and ADHD at the same level as boys are, clearly there are also girls who are seen as exhibiting abnormal behavior to whatever expectations there are about girl behavior, you know, mm-hmm. very active, physically active little girls, and then they get branded abnormal as well, maybe not given these diagnoses, but, you know, that there seem to be fairly rigid ideas about what is normal, and children who fall beyond that can really end up, you know, in a bad situation.
Yeah, well, especially in a classroom setting. I mean, I think that, you know, what is a normal activity level? What is a normal attention span? What is, you know, a normal, not all children are people, are social and given to be social and may be more introverted by temperament than extroverted. And I say it, I actually think that even though in America we want to see ourselves as embracing diversity, one of the areas I think when we're probably, you know, less likely to embrace that diversity is in the social and emotional realm. Being able to kind of adapt educational, pedagogical environments to children across a range of temperaments, activity levels, attention spans, and whatnot.
Dr. Enrico Naladi is my guest. We'll return with him in just a moment. Listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Enrico Naladi. He's a clinical psychologist specializing in childhood and adolescent therapy and assessment, author of the book Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. That's published by Beacon Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'd like to turn now to a diagnosis that is frequently made within adolescence, and that is bipolar disorder. There's been an explosion of diagnosis of bipolar disorder, and I wonder if you could tell listeners what are the characteristics of bipolar disorder and then how they get frequently, as you see it, confused with normal, albeit sometimes unpleasant behavior.
Well, classic bipolar disorder, it used to be called manic depressive illness, not unlike autism, I think, on the surface, when it's present in its clearest form, is relatively easy to diagnose. So some of the hallmarks of bipolar disorder, what clinicians call a labile mood, someone who can go from being relatively chipper and upbeat to tearful or enraged with some minor kind of precipitant. So true mood swings what triggers that, those mood swings on the surface seem fairly inconsequential. So you've got that, you know, a high degree of impulsivity, a lack of a need for sleep. So someone who might go a day or two without sleep, impulsively calling family members in the middle of the night. Maybe they're hypersexual and impulsively acting out sexually. There's also what's called tangential thinking. So a person may jump around and their verbalizations going from one thought to another without there being, you know, a great deal of internal consistency with sort of what they're talking about. And then pressured speech is one of the hallmarks of bipolar disorder. Motor mouth, someone who just is talking endlessly with pressure, like they can't help but say what needs to be said and say it as long as it needs to be said. These are some of the hallmarks of bipolar disorder. The criteria shifted about 20 years ago that really then created, I would say, sort of a dragnet for teenagers that are going through a fairly difficult adolescent passage to be misdiagnosed. So agitation became one of the hallmarks of adolescent bipolar disorder or pediatric bipolar disorder. So kids who would just had a short fuse and would flare up and teenagers who really showed unusual signs of just becoming enraged and slamming doors, yelling, screaming, becoming highly argumentative. Teenagers with that presentation now were more likely to be assigned a diagnosis to the exclusion of some of these other classic symptoms of bipolar disorder, which was always kind of confusing to me. Merely a kid who was just sort of like agitated and impulsive to unusual levels. Ooh, now that would be a kid that in the current zeitgeist would be on a clinician's radar to get a diagnosis of bipolar disorder.
Adolescents are, of course, famously known for not getting enough sleep. And I was wondering how much of this is a factor in the behaviors that then are perhaps misdiagnosed as psychiatric disorders.
I have a whole section in my book on that, and I agree with that basic premise. Like kids that have chronic sleep deprivation and overuse caffeine in ways that can impair their sleep can present with reduced self-regulation of emotion in general, so more irritable, more moody, more cranky, shorter fuse, and cognitively cloudy and problems concentrating and attending. I think that chronic sleep deprivation is probably one possible pathway to a false diagnosis.
The program's Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm joined by clinical psychologist Enrico Nalotti, author of Back to Normal. Well, let's talk about this bigger picture that you've been discussing through the hour of what you see as the overdiagnosis of various psychiatric disorders, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder being one, bipolar disorder, autism spectrum disorder. What drives this overdiagnosis? You've talked about it in different ways, but I wonder what are the key facets that have led to such an increase in these diagnoses from this generation to the last. You've mentioned somewhat the orientation of doctors and therapists in making diagnoses. To what degree does their education influence the tendency to give children psychiatric diagnoses?
Well, I can start there, but I think there's a complex web of factors that sort of explain these diagnoses that we've been discussing. I mean, I agree with you that the sort of the education and training of health and mental health professionals often lacks adequate background in child development. And, you know, they often don't have a good paradigm in their head for what constitutes normal. And what they do have is often of a textbook academic nature. They may be well-versed in identifying abnormality, but have a hard time teasing out what is on the outer edges of normal, comparing that to what is actually abnormal. So it has partly to do with the education and training of health and mental health professionals. You know, as upwards of like 40% of new child psychologists haven't taken any courses in child development. 40% of pediatricians haven't even completed a residency in pediatric mental health. So, you know, it has to do with the education training of health and mental health professionals. It has to do with, you know, the obvious, the spectacular marketing success of the pharmaceutical industry and making the American public easygoing about medicalizing and medicating children's behavior. I think as a society, we become casual, loose, and folksy in discussing childhood diagnoses. So much so that by the time a parent enters a doctor's office, they sort of nonchalantly self-diagnose their child. I mean, if you've watched Simpson episodes, South Park episodes, you know, they showcase ADHD in popular culture in ways. We hype the word hyperactive, the term short attention span, forgetful. ADHD, we use it in such folksy ways, most new cases of ADHD occur in a pediatrician's office. The average length of a pediatric visit right now is about 15 minutes. So, you know, if a parent comes in already predisposed to kind of use symptom language, and they confirm with the pediatrician who wants them to cut to the chase and use clinical shorthand to arrive at a you could see how the conditions seem to promote a quick diagnosis. The diagnostic habits of mental health professionals have also changed. There's much more of a trend towards what's called upcoding or rebranding. In other words, assigning a more severe diagnosis in order to authorize services through insurance companies. Insurance companies have just become much tighter and what they'll approve of in the way of services, and many clinicians adapt by upcoding, assigning a more severe diagnosis in order to just authorize services. So these are some of the reasons why I think over the past few generations we've seen, you know, an uptick or a big uptick in, you know, these diagnoses.
Can you tell us a bit more about the role that pharmaceutical companies play in influencing the diagnosis that children get around these mental health disorders?
Well, one of the big ones, of course, it has to do with a pediatric bipolar disorder. In fact, it's only now that we've really seen the light, so to speak, that pharmaceutical companies promoting what are called off-label uses of what are called the newer antipsychotics. These are medications like Abilify, Seroquel, Geodon, Zyprexa, Risperdal. These medications are extraordinarily profitable. In fact, Abilify, I believe it was in 2014, was the most profitable drug of any drug in America. And it's used for treating bipolar disorder. And one of the reasons that drug in particular and the others that I just quoted have had, you know, been prescribed in skyrocketing rates is deeply wedded to the more looser and more frequent diagnosis of pediatric bipolar disorder. The pharmaceutical industry went out of its way to handsomely reward psychiatrists and pediatricians who would openly promote the uses of these off-label uses. They're not approved, many of them, by the FDA for use with an approved medication for pediatric bipolar disorder, but physicians are allowed to prescribe medications for what are called off-label reasons, and the pharmaceutical companies sort of took full advantage of that loophole going back a decade or two and promoting these newer antipsychotics that became highly profitable and really shaped many clinicians' diagnostic habits. We're just coming to terms with that right now. A lot of the abuses in the system have been uncovered, and there are new rules that are applying. I think under the Obama administration that physicians can only get like $1,000 or something like that if they give a talk to a pharmaceutical, you know, from a pharmaceutical company to promote a medication. Before, it was the sky was the limit, and doctors could make millions of dollars flying around using kind of sketchy research to promote off-label uses, in particular of the newer antipsychotics, to address pediatric bipolar disorder.
Well, let me end by asking you, what do you think parents should do if they feel like their children are exhibiting worrisome behavior or simply difficult behavior?
I would say you start by exercising common sense. You start, like you said earlier, Sasha, you look, you know, I look for the obvious things first: sleeping, eating, the emotional tenor of the household are things relatively smooth and calm enough of the time, or chaotic too much of the time. Children are, we underestimate how attachment sensitive they are. If you have an occupation that makes you highly preoccupied a lot of the time, your physical coming and going sort of erratic, when you come home, when you pick a child up after school, that time varies from day to day, that alone, an erratic attachment pattern throughout early childhood can create a symptomatic child. So you start with the obvious things first. Is there a mismatch between a child's educational environment and where they're at developmentally? So I would say first start there. Then if the problems persist, then I think it's time to try to seek out a qualified mental health professional. And unfortunately, I think you're going to have to do your research to find someone who is not only credentialed, but who, you know, has a broad knowledge of normal childhood, and that maybe they themselves have kids, or they themselves were once a teacher, or they themselves once worked in a summer camp, they themselves came from a big family and were put in a parental role with siblings. Believe it or not, I think that these normal human things are, you know, add to a child psychologist's skill level and repertoire.
I've been speaking with Enrico Naulati. He's a clinical psychologist specializing in childhood and adolescent therapy and assessment. He is the author of Back to Normal: Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. That's published by Beacon Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Thank you so much for joining me today.
You are very welcome, Sasha.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time.
the Grain is produced by Sasha, Lily, and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.